Matthew Parks from COSATU. Chair, I think I want to start off by thanking the committee members from all the parties for their approach on this bill. I think we really appreciate as COSATU the approach members have taken from all parties, and that by and large on a rare occasion in Parliament you've got cross-party consensus virtually. Chair, I think in terms of why is COSATU here, look, we have 800,000 members who are public servants who fall under the GEPF. This includes Nahau, Satu, Popcrew, Denosa, Pausa, Sama, the medical doctors, and a new affiliate of COSATU, the paramedics union. Basically, we represent two-thirds of the GEPF membership in the PSCBC. If we include our good comrades on my left from FEDUSA, combined we have more than 90% of the public service. So we have a vested interest in this issue, Chair. Chair, I won't go too much into the challenges facing the PIC. But I think maybe just to make a few...
Can I just read some procedural issues? We have two bills before us, right? We have Mr. Mania's private members bill, and we have the committee bill. There is quite a lot of overlap. There are about four areas in which there's no agreement. So it will be useful for all people who are making submissions. So there's a fairness. You don't look only at the Standing Committee on Finance bill. And I want to record this. I think it's only fair. You see, Mr. Mania did his work, and he came with a bill very fast. If I'm correct, he tabled it in December, right? Sometime early December. Then Parliament doesn't sit, right? And then what happens is when he came back, he had gone through all the processes. And to remind members here, and I think it's correct, by the way, Tony, the Constitutional Court decided that partly as a comradely genuflection, right? I didn't like say you disagree. That actually the Court decided that this Parliament cannot just receive a private member's bill and say, no, by majority decision. That's wrong. We're a multi-party democracy. Something I've always believed, by the way, and I'm glad to be here. So I won't look at you declare, I always believe that, right? And I'm glad that the decision was taken. So in fairness to him, we approached him and said to him, look, we can have two separate public hearings, but why don't we converge those, you know? We'll have them both. both of us. Convertible didn't work. But so sometimes you want to comment, it'll be useful for the committee to know where the two bills disagree. Where do you tend to want? In other words, there are four areas I think where we disagree. One is we feel the executive should appoint the chairperson of the board, either the minister or the deputy minister. In practice, it's not such a deputy minister. The reason being that obviously at the end of the day, the fiscus will have to come to the rescue if in fact the PIC and DUP have failed in some way. And so government's budget is at issue. And we feel that trade unions should have up to three representatives. In Mr. Mania's bill, he talks about one, and he wants the chairperson to be independent. So tell us what you think of that. We've set investment criteria out, bearing in mind that you must get rate of return. That came from the union movement, by the one section of it. Then the other issue I think we disagree on is, I think that's the two major things. I've forgotten what the other. What's the other one, Mr. Mania? There's a difference? Yeah, there's a good. Okay. So it's nice to hear from you. And you must address Mr. Mania's book. Thank you, as well.
Well, thanks, Chair. Yes, we'll do exactly that. And I think we must also appreciate Mr. Mania, even though he's from the DA, as COSATU, for jumping headstrong and responding to COSATU's demands. But, Chair, look, also the Private Members' Bill are a good evolution of Parliament. We support as COSATU a Private Members' Bill by the ACDP last year around parental leave, so we think it's a good thing. And you can show maturity of political parties across the party divides. But yes, we'll comment on both bills, Chair. Yes, Chair, look, I think just in summary on the challenges facing the PIC, I think just to make the point that we often forget that the PIC is investing workers' money, whether it's a public service pension fund or it's workers' insurance taxes through the UAF or COIDA. But I think, Chair, also having said that, we appreciate the unique role of the PIC in the economy. When we're sitting with one out of three workers unemployed long-term, our levels of poverty and inequality are well-known. And I think, Chair, we're also, as COSATU, worried about the continuous headlines we see about different investments. The whole climate of state capture has really forced us to pull up our socks and to plan for these kind of issues. I think, Chair, also, as COSATU, we were deeply alarmed over the past few years when many ministers, even for good intentions, have said, no, let the PIC sort out tertiary education, let it sort out NHI, let it sort out public transport. And if we do that kind of approach, we're going to bankrupt the PIC. I think lastly on this point, Chair, just to show that COSATU are not being alarmist or paranoid unnecessarily, but to quote the President when he said to us last year that there are dangerous eyes watching the PIC. Chair, it's very difficult for us over the past 8 years' experience to take government promises of no corruption to heart. There have been countless episodes, and I think you would know better than us on it. We don't want to see our state-owned enterprises collapse, but also we can't be using the PIC as a piggy bank to cover up mismanagement, etc. Chair, our members are also scarred by the experiences of what happened to the pension funds in Transnet, and Fidentia, and of course we're also equally worried, etc., by the your rating agencies and the threat to downgrade us, etc., and the consequences for the economy. I think lastly on this point, Chair, also that we've seen how state organs have been abused, especially the criminal justice system, and the need to overhaul that, Chair. Chair, then to come strictly to the two bills, I think in the committee bill, we are going to sing your praises 100%. We support the investment mandate 100%. We think it's fantastic. We understand the PIC will say they do get a mandate from the GPF. It's not necessarily put in law. But I think, look, the more clarity, the more transparency we have, the better. We're very happy with the investment mandate given. Number one, to secure the depositors' rate of return. And that's number one key, public service pension money, UAF, COIDA. But also, Chair, given the state of our economy, given the strategic role of the PIC at 1.9 trillion rand, the largest fund in the continent, we think it should be given the task of creating and protecting local jobs, supporting industrialization, manufacturing, export, which is really the key to turning our economy around. But also, Chair, I think given, for example, you mentioned the water crisis earlier, the need for us to incorporate principles of sustainable development when we grow the economy. For those members who like to drink wine, you know, the fact that it takes 1,000 liters of water to produce 1 liter of wine shows you how we need to be much smarter about how we grow the economy, etc., for long-term sustainability. I think lastly, Chair, we very strongly welcome the clause saying we must prioritize investment in South Africa. Not that we need to ban external investments, but we need to grow our economy first at home. And we can't complain about or wait for international investments when you've got this PIC jewel which can drive us. Chair, we support the other clauses around developmental objectives, a capacitated state, transforming the economy. And I think, Chair, we're also very glad about the last clause, providing a space to assist GPF members purchasing housing. And I think that the wording is all right, because it's saying may. It's not obligatory. I think it'll give space for the PSCBC to have discussion to say that catchy public servants, maybe your nurses, etc., who can't afford getting a home loan, don't qualify for RDP housing, there is space for the GPF to assist them in a sustainable way. And I think lastly, Chair, we want to say we're very glad there's no clause saying that the PIC is a slush fund for ministers. So maybe we can just share with our cabinet comments. Sorry, Chair, you know, some of them are very naughty, but Chair, in terms of so we're very glad there's with the SCOF bill in that regard. We do know that it's not in the Honourable Mayor's bill. Chair, in terms of the PIC board also, which is very key for us, I think the worrying thing is that in the existing act, it basically gives a blank check to the minister to constitute the board, only having to consult depositors and cabinet. I think in terms of the committee bill, I think we're willing to accept the need for the minister or the deputy minister of finance to chair the board. It's a key government investment fund. We were a bit hesitant initially, but we're willing to be reasonable to accept that. We're comfortable with having a treasury representative. Chair, I think it's also fair that you have a space for major shareholders' representation. So, for example, the GPF as the 87% shareholder. Then, in terms of the union representation, which has been a very hot, emotional, lightning rod issue for trade unions, we're not really comfortable with the private members' bill proposal of one union rep, which should be selected by the minister. We think that would open the possibility for friendship and abuses. A minister could take a rep from a small trade union of 200 members and ignore more vociferous unions. We prefer the committee bill proposal of 2 to 3 trade union representations selected by the Public Service Central Bargaining Council. We think that helps to provide a stronger linkage for those union reps to the PSCBC. And also, Chair, look, having one person is easy to bribe one person. It's much more difficult to bribe 2 or 3. And also, it helps us to police each other, make sure our members behave. But also, Chair, if you have 2 or 3 reps, it enables to build worker unity. So, for example, you'd have 2 from COSATU as the majority federation, 1 from FEDUSA, for example. Chair, in terms of the ministerial directives, again, it's a clause we support wholeheartedly. I think the committee bill captures it quite well, that the minister's directives are not just a blank check, as they are currently in the act of simply being rational or reasonable, but that it's based upon the developmental mandate, or the investment mandate, rather, is tabled before Parliament, depositors, and it's on the website. Chair, we think the transparency objectives there are fantastic and should be supported. Chair, in terms of the PIC reports, we welcome the proposed tabling before Parliament, publication on the website. Our one proposal there is just a small technical one, but for sequential flow, is that they should also be tabled before the major depositors as well, even just for courtesy purposes, but I think it's important. We do know that that is the practice currently, but I think it's just good to codify it in law, and it flows with the spirit of the bill, the committee bill. Chair, in terms of the tabling of requests, I will support the bill's proposals to include them with the annual report, and thus tabled before Parliament. Chair, if we understand correctly, then maybe you just want to tighten the wording to say they should also be tabled before the major depositors as well. But if it's part of the annual report, automatically as an appendix, that might not be necessary. Chair, then coming towards the end, in terms of the regulations, we welcome the bill's proposals around parliamentary processes. Our one proposal there, and I think is based upon the precedence of other regulations, how they are processed, is also to have a space for engagement with major shareholders, so the UIF, GPF, etc., and perhaps also to have a clause allowing for public comment as well. I think that's the standard normal with regards to regulations, and it could easily be incorporated, Chair. I think it will just help to entrench the transparency, accountability, spirit, etc. So, Chair, I think in conclusion, this is for us is a very key issue. We think this is one of the most important bills of this parliamentary term. We really want to commend the members. You are making history. We suspect you'll be in the first committee to pass a committee bill, which again is the evolution of Parliament. Again, to make the point, Chair, that the PIC is investing workers' money. It's not investing government money. We support the bills wholeheartedly, but I think we support the scoff bill in particular because of the clauses around the investment mandate, the union representation, etc., the ministerial directives. We think the committee can come with one bill at the end of the day. Then, Chair, just lastly, our proposals around the tabling of reports, the regulations and directives, public consultation, and so on. And then, yes, Chair, I think lastly, again, it's very unusual that we are praising members, but I think members have really done fantastic work across party lines. Lastly, Chair, that we want to see this bill passed, if not by tomorrow, but next week, but at least before you go and campaign for elections later this year or next year. Thanks very much, Chairperson.
Thanks. FEDUSA and Public Service, which is an affiliate of yours, both want to give one submission. Is that correct?
Yes, so that is. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Basically, our interest in the amendments to the bill is as stated by Kusatu. We have got a vested interest representing public servants who are members of the GEPF, who is a main contributor and client of the PIC. What is important to note that the money invested by the PIC and the money collected by the GEPF is not state funds. It belongs to public servants. Even the employer contribution, which is added to the employee contribution, is postponed remuneration and belongs to that public servant. So therefore, we as public servants have a vested interest in the dealings of the PIC. We regard ourselves as depositors and the main depositor in that regard. As such, I will, to save time, go directly to our proposals and comments on the bills. The Section 2, proposed Section 5.2, this section we believe needs to be reconsidered. It should be clearly expressed to be subject to any investment mandate that may be given by any of the investors. It must allow the depositors to determine their own investment mandate and must oblige the PIC to set and to act accordingly. The phrase securing funds, investments, financial sustainability and security, in our opinion, is vague. Am I speaking to... sorry, ma'am. Apologies.
I've got it. It's here.
No, unfortunately, we don't have a PowerPoint. It is, we have a submission which was submitted.
You see, that's the new generation. Old generation.
You see, I'm also from the X generation.
Yeah. Well, look, we emailed it to members yesterday, and you've got, there's no obligation on it. It's fine.
My apologies, sir. Ma'am. The phrase securing funds, investment, financial sustainability and security is vague. And it is inconsistent with the investment mandate which should be given by pension funds to their investment manager. And that is the interest of a pension fund and their members and beneficiaries should take preference over any other interest. While it could be noted that the state is obliged to guarantee the benefits promised by the GEPF to its members, and failure of the investments of the GEPF affects the ability of the GEPF to meet its pension obligations and to improve such benefits, to keep pace with inflation and to keep the employer contribution rate stable. Section 2, proposed Section 5.3, we believe that this provision at this stage does not have a place in the PIC Act and should be deleted, as should the proposed definition of property in Section 1. The rules of a GPF currently makes no provision for assistance to members for the purpose of buying property. It is inconsistent, therefore, for the PIC to provide that assistance using GPF funds. If a provision of such assistance is desired, then the GEP law and the GEP rules should first be amended. Section 3, proposed amendment of Section 6.2, and I think this also speaks to Mr. Mania's issue on the board, the chairperson of the board. It is not acceptable that the obligation to have regard to nominations submitted by depositors is deleted in respect of the 12 members of the board. Since the PIC invests the assets belonging to the depositors, it is fundamental that depositors should have their views heard on who is to manage their money. In addition, the minister should be under a statutory obligation to call for nominations from depositors and members of the public and to have regard to those nominations in making any appointment. What makes a depositor a major depositor should be defined. Having regard to the table at paragraph 10 of our submission, it is obvious that the GEPF is a major depositor managing close to 87.72% of the funds managed by, or owning up to 87.72% of the funds managed by the PIC. It is by far the largest, the GEPF is by far the largest client of the PIC, and while its active or contributing members are represented by the trade union parties to the PSCBC, GEPF pensioners are not. There are 400,000 such pensioners, and it is proposed, therefore, that the list should include one pensioner member of a GEPF nominated by the GEPF. In regard to the proposed subsection 2B3, the fiducia proposes that these members be nominated not by reference to membership of a GEPF, but by the free trade unions in the PSCBC with the largest membership, as determined by the PSCBC vote weighting determination procedures. In any event, the idea of proportional composition needs to be clarified. Is it proportional to the membership of each of the unions, or is it proportional to the members of the unions who are also members of a GEPF? Section 3, proposed amendment of Section 6.5. The directive in subsection 4 relates to the management of a PIC if it is in the public interest to do so and if it is reasonably necessary to do so. The proposed Section 5A is not acceptable unless the suggested changes are made to the Section 5 as discussed in paragraphs 21 and 25 of our submission. In addition, there is little point in complying with this section after the directive is issued. The ability to issue directives of this nature is in effect giving the minister the power to undermine the independence of the board of the PIC in a way which stakeholders already are not able to do. It is important, therefore, that interested parties be given an opportunity to comment before directives are issued. Section 4, proposed amendment to Section 10. This should be expressed to be subject to any agreement with or mandate given by a depositor. Section 5, proposed amendment to Section 11A. There should be a definition of significant transactions. Section 6, proposed amendment to Section 12. This is a transitional provision, and while the intention is clear, it needs to be worked out in greater detail. It is not known, for example, what the term of office of current board members are. Further comments on the Public Investment Corporation, the Private Members Bill, Section 2, Mr. Mania, proposed amendment to Section 6.1 and 2. The formulation of subsection 1 makes clear the point which is raised in paragraph 31 of these submissions. It also excludes the idea that the minister or the deputy minister is to act as the chairperson. This formulation is to be preferred, the one we say the board should elect their own chairperson from amongst its members. For the reasons set out in paragraph 33 and 34 of our submission, FEDUSA does not agree that the obligation to have regard to the nomination submitted by depositors should be deleted. The FEDUSA wants to go further and submit that the minister should be obliged to call for nominations, not only in relation to the appointment of a chairperson, but for all board appointments, and must then have regard to those nominations. As suggested above, the minister should be obliged to consult with depositors before making any appointments. It is noted that no amendment is proposed to subsection 3, and the FEDUSA supports this. FEDUSA considers that the chairperson should be appointed by the minister from amongst those appointed to the board, is after following the prescribed process for appointment of the members of the board. In regard to the proposed subsection C, FEDUSA repeats the submissions made in paragraph 35 and 36 of our submission. In regard to the proposed subsection 5, FEDUSA repeat our submission in paragraphs 39 and 41. Section 4, proposed amendment to section 11A, there should be a definition for significant transactions, as we have already stated. Section 5, proposed amendment to section 12, these are transitional provisions, and while the intention is clear, it needs to be worked out in greater detail. It is not known, as we have stated earlier, what the term of the current board members are. The proposal of subsection 13 is also supported by FEDUSA. Thank you, Chairperson.
Just to alert you, the way the committee works is that every proposal you make, whether we agree or disagree with it, is irrelevant. We put it into a table.
Yeah.
So when you go through the bill, we look at clause 4, clause 5. Now, just a procedural matter, or an administrative matter. Normally, it's done by the department because we're overworked and understaffed here. But this is a committee bill, Frank. So the table would be done with Nolotando, yourself, Sakele, and Antonio. But you could send it to MP to look at. But they have a vested interest in this bill that's contrary to what the committee wants. So you can't take their, with due respect. Parliament must handle its own bill. So can I alert you, by Tuesday next week when we're sitting, the day before, we'll have to have the table. It's relatively easy to do because there's so few submissions. Okay? Thank you. Right, next then is Amabungane. Center for Investigative Journalism. There you are.
See, these guys carry two computers, so they mislead you not to understand where the information is, so they have to interchangeably look for the information for the computer.
Yeah, but the guys in the computer aging very slow. I thought you have tip, you might have a small computer that gets things on. Right.
Do you know if it might is going to... Right. Okay,
who you are.
Right, we shall do so shortly, just sort out the technical details. So, my name is Stefan Sprummer, I am with Amabungane, so is Craig McCune. I was hoping that Karabo back there could introduce us and do some of the preliminaries, but few small benches here. So,
where's Karabo?
She's right here.
Where?
Yeah.
Why is he hiding? Oh, she. Yes, of course, you exchanged with me, right?
Yes.
Yeah, contrary to what you say about Parliament, we allowed you to make a submission even after the deadline, right?
Thank
so
you.
So we're not some neo-authoritarian, neo-fascistic thing in the way we project it, but over to you. Which
so
Parliament does that?
To thank you for the opportunity and also to emphasize this was done in a big rush. We did not engage as much as we would have liked to with the Mania Bill, but there will be small reference to that. Now, to tell you quickly about Namabungane, we're an investigative journalism center, a non-profit. Our aim is to promote open, accountable, and just democracy. We do this through the best practice of investigative journalism. We expose wrongdoing that empowers people to hold power to account. You may well know of our investigative work, the latest being the Gupta leaks. We also support others to do investigative journalism, so an outreach. And then importantly, for present purposes, we have an advocacy program. And this is really a shop issue for investigative journalists. We help to secure the information right, so it's access to information, for example, that are the lifeblood of our field. So in terms of that advocacy mandate of ours, we limit our representations here only to the Transparency Act aspects of the bill. Also to point out that though we are here to represent investigative journalists as a class, that any information rights that benefit us by extension benefits the media in general and of course the public in general. Information rights are indivisible. So first, the general background, the rationale for greater transparency. And again, we really appreciate that the committee has grappled, as has Mr. Mania, with the issue of transparency. It's not just mandate, board representation, etc. So currently, the PIC labors under very, very limited disclosure provisions. This against the recurring allegations that PIC power is abused for individual benefit or for political or fashionable patronage. It is trite that disclosure deters bad decision making, even if retrospective. Now, to also emphasize that the proposed Section 5 of the committee bill, which would expand the public role for the PIC, jobs, development, industrialization, transformation, that again, this means that the entire public, not just civil service pensioners, would have a stake in PIC investment outcomes. It makes the information around the PIC an issue for us all. And also, I think this point has been made by others, that the PIC invests on behalf of the GEPF, whose obligations are guaranteed by the state. So again, if there's PIC failure, if there's GEPF failure, this becomes an issue for all of us. It's our money that's going to be used to bail them out. And again, to extend the argument, PIC economic muscle is enormous. It is the biggest investor by far in the South African economy. Any kind of risk to PIC is systemic risk to all of us. To get to some details, this presentation does not deal with the ministerial directives and the application to the minister, but those, like any other transparency provision, we are in favor of. To get to the issue of board selection, it is proposed that the minister will appoint board members in consultation with cabinet in the committee bill. The Mania bill goes slightly further and requires National Assembly engagement with the chair's selection. Now, we would like to propose, for the sake of transparency participation, that there should be a public interview process, confirmation process for all board members. I think the public has a legitimate interest in who are the board members. So we're not commenting on who should we be proposing them, but this should certainly include public nominations, and it should certainly include a public interviewing and confirmation process in the National Assembly. To get to the key disclosure provision in the current suggested both forms of the bill, in the committee bill, that is clause 4, which would amend section 10 of the current act, it requires annual disclosure of investments. We wholeheartedly support this provision. It is key to the transparency that is required, but we would like it to go further. First, we should perhaps just deal with the objections that have come from National Treasury, perhaps motivated by the PIC and GEPF. Now, the motivation, the objection was expressed as follows. The PIC as asset manager should not be compelled to disclose information about another entity, and then there's reference to the GEPF. Now, we failed to understand this objective. First of all, this proposal would simply codify the practice of the past 2 years, which we understand to have been motivated by Treasury and or the Deputy Minister of Finance at the time. Secondly, there is absolutely no evidence that the disclosures that have been made over the past 2 years, that they have done any harm. Thirdly, the GEPF is also a public entity. So the legislature can impose consent from its side. That is within your power. And finally, perhaps there's nothing new in imposing transparency on the GEPF. Its law imposes significant disclosure requirements already, including its annual report, which has to carry quite a bit of detail, including about investments. So this would simply take it a bit further and codify it. And again, one might just make reference again to the public interest in this matter, because the GEPF's obligations are guaranteed by the state. We note that the committee bill and the Mania bill, as far as I'm aware, does not state what classes of information should be disclosed, simply that it should be a report reflecting all investments, whether listed or unlisted. Now, we imagine that it's a matter for regulation to specify which classes of information should be disclosed. Now, just a few examples, and our written presentation has a much fuller list. But for example, the price paid for an investment, the extent of any discount, and this is important because this is stuff that we hear about where for a number of reasons, for example, let's say the PIC warehouses shares for an empowerment transaction, that there may be a discount. Now, a discount for BEE reasons could be perfectly legitimate, but again, it's the kind of thing that should be open to the public to interrogate whether it was a due discount or an undue discount. What we also are hearing quite a bit about is that there are all sorts of fees being paid for in the course of these transactions, so-called transaction advisory fees, introductory fees, etc. Now, this is completely opaque at the moment. People are walking away with tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of rands in fees on big deals. This is clearly a matter of public interest. The PIC sometimes apparently pays these fees. Sometimes it funds investee companies to pay these fees. Now, either way, this is a matter of great public interest. I think in the examples that we're going to get to later, we shall expand on that. In terms of getting the regulations to properly define the classes of information that should be disclosed, I think one wants to potentially strengthen the regulations. First of all, provisions as to how the regulations are made. First of all, one wants to specify that the minister must specify the classes of information. That must be obligatory. Secondly, and I think this is something which has come up in a previous representation, is that the process must not include only consultation by the Minister of the National Assembly, but in fact public participation and then approval by the National Assembly. Then finally, from my side, before I hand over, we want to make a radical proposal of extending disclosure, not just the actual investments should be disclosed, but also the process by which these investment decisions were taken. Again, leaks recently in the public domain show that in some cases internal concerns about risky investments were ignored, and that conditions precedent specified in the course of the approval process were not applied. So again, the solution is radical transparency, and what we would like to propose is the insertion of a PIA-like provision for access to investment decision minutes. PIA itself will not be the appropriate vehicle, simply because, amongst other reasons, it excludes minutes of a decision-making process by a public body. So what we propose is something similar to the direct access provision that you find in the Companies Act for certain classes of information. Write that in, any member of the public can request, and the PIC must disclose in 7 days any minute regarding an investment decision. Of course, that will be controversial. I'm sure the gentleman sitting some distance behind me is going to object vehemently. We do recognize that commercial confidentiality is an issue, so let's put in a provision that disclosure may be refused for reasons of commercial confidentiality, but only if reasonable efforts have been made to redact. So first redact. If you can't redact, then sure, do not disclose. But if there is an overriding public interest, do disclose after all. So I'm going to hand over to Craig, and he can take you through some of the examples of public disclosures, or rather media disclosures recently and historically, regarding big investment decisions.
Hi, I'm Craig. I'm a journalist at Adama Bungani, and let me just go through a few case studies very quickly. I'll spare us all the weeds, as I am conscious of time. Some of the stories that have come out in the press since, you know, more, over the last 15 years, they highlight that there is often quite a bit of political exposure to PIC-funded deals, deals stacked with politically connected people, often people connected to the ANC, more specifically often people connected to the ANC Treasury. But those aren't the only sorts of problems. In other cases, there'll be frequently empowered people. They're repeat beneficiaries of PIC largesse, and sometimes on unclear or maybe questionable terms. We're often not sure, but we do our best to report on it with the limited information that is available. Anyway, let me just move on. 2005, I think it was, the PIC funded a consortium which bought Telkom shares. This was before my time, but it raised considerable controversy, particularly because of the ANC links, or the reported ANC links to the deal. Slightly more recently, in 2007, the IDC funded a BE consortium which bought Capitec BE shares. In 2012, the PIC came along and bought out a large portion of those shares, leaving those BE partners with free shares and dividends. So it put them in a very good position. Concerns were raised at the time because once again there were serious political links to the deal. You can see there ANC fundraisers, sponsors, regiments who's featured more recently in the news related to the Guptas. The former head of the PICCC Bayer Fund, Chepo Mahluele, and his company Harith, and so on. And it just so happens that same Mr. Mahluele has recently been funded on two further occasions to buy more Capitec shares, which we're quite interested in, and we'd like to know more about those terms. But it takes considerable and sometimes a ridiculous amount of work to obtain very basic information about such deals. Independent newspapers That's been quite well covered. Dr. Iqbal Server and his company bought out the newspaper company in 2013. It was funded by the PIC, and by all accounts, that purchase price was hugely overfunded, and that seems to have been borne out by the newspaper company's progress since then. Huge debt, battling to repay the PIC. Also a very, I think I can say, bad journalism quite often, particularly partisan journalism, often politically partisan, often just supporting the newspaper owners' own ends. And yeah, next one. 2014, the PIC bought into...
You're right, 15 minutes, but because others haven't used up their time, we'll allow it. You see, this sort of thing we'll read anyway, and we're familiar with, so if we can just summarize them.
Sure.
Go through each case, but we're familiar with them.
Right, okay.
And obviously the chairs, chair and the work and so on, will read everything. It'll be itemized. But I think we get the drift. So if you can take 3-4 minutes, 3 minutes maximum.
Yep.
There's not three on the other.
Okay. A very dodgy oil deal offshore of Nigeria, featuring a friend of the president at the time, recently went bankrupt. That deal was obviously a bad deal at the time. We wrote about it then, and we were horrified to see it go down the tubes more recently. Another one, and this one features a man who more recently features in the allegations that the PIC CEO channeled money to his girlfriend, which he denies. But yeah, when we're trying to interrogate this deal, we run into secrecy at the PIC. You know, this is not something that you've read in the press, but we've come across a 100 million rand discrepancy. The PIC provided 1.8 billion rand, but that was to buy shares for 1.7 billion rand. So where did that 100 million rand go? The difference, and it took considerable work to get the PIC to confirm, yes, those were transaction-related costs. Well, so who got the 100 million rand? The PIC's response to us was, the response we have given you is sufficient. It's not. And the same thing's happening on the Steinhoff BE deal, where we found a similar discrepancy, 400 million rand, that's gone off to transaction costs. The PIC's response to us, or as to why they won't break down those costs, I think we've disclosed what we want to disclose, indeed. And I think everyone's more aware of the recent coverage of Iqbal Survey's more recent deals, Sagamatha and IO Technologies. Thank you.
I wasn't rushing you, but I mean, we're familiar with these issues, you know, when you're just pointing out the cases. Right? And in fact, the next tranche of the oversight is next Tuesday. On the PIC issues. But having said that, who's next? Right, fine. Let's have the discussion. We've got about 7 minutes more than we planned to, which is great. Over to members. We excuse time. At 11:30, we understand.
Yes. Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. Just a comment on two issues, and perhaps it's something that requires further sort of discussion and interaction on. I'm fully in favor of the question of representation. But I think we shouldn't also necessarily fool ourselves to think that representation itself guarantees certain outcomes. Because if we do that, we'll be completely wrong. For instance, just to give you an example, I was once a Director General of the Department of Labor. And the compensation fund was one of the entities that I was responsible for. And in that particular board, you also had union representation. And the compensation fund had been, you know, at the time, had about four disclaimer sort of audit opinions for a period of over 4 years consecutively. And that's, of course, when the board was there. But also the very same board was complicit in supporting resistance from the side of management, for instance, to turn around that disadvantage. Now, what does it then say to the union representation that you found in the consultants? So the question for me would be that I think not only with regards to the PIC, but I think broadly speaking in terms of public entities and institutions in our society, we do need to begin to interrogate and investigate quite thoroughly the kind of oversight mechanisms and public management mechanisms that we do need to effect to ensure better outcomes and performance of the entities and institutions in question. And I think we seem not to be investing quite a lot in that. For instance, one of the debates that I've got, and I think it's, let me also declare that I'm probably conflicted in a sense as a student of cooperative governance kind of issues, that we seem to think that management of institutions lies with boards, and therefore we invest quite a lot in following that kind of thinking, and invest less, and I think we seem to be investing quite less on really the technical aspects of management of institutions and so on. And I think for me, the fact that we are failing to strike the balance between the two, maybe renders us to a situation where we are able then to deal with the challenges as they present themselves. So that's the one point. The second point I wanted to raise, Amapungane, they talk about disclosure, and they say where there is an overriding interest, there should be disclosure. Now, I let me just say that I still have got to think about the whole question of what does that do, for instance, to business practices and ethics and so on. I think it's something that I would love to go back to. But here's another question, which I think also goes back to the main issue, the oversight question and public management issue. Who makes a determination about an overriding interest? Who makes that call? Who says this is an overriding interest and therefore we will disclose it yourselves as a Mapungane? Which would be irregular, by the way, if you agree that it should be that. Or is it PIC or any other entity for that matter and so on? So again, Honourable Chair, it brings us back to this question. What kind of, intact kind of oversight mechanisms do we then put in place so that we can then guarantee towards the output of certain principles and so on, and practices in these particular entities. So I wanted to raise those two issues. Thanks very much, and thanks for also informing honourable members that at 11:30 I would love to be excused, and not that I'm imposing myself on you as per your SMS, Honourable Chair. Thank you very much.
Time to tell about this. But that's the, for those of you who don't, that's the Honourable Former Secretary General of the TNG, Transport and General Workers Union. I hope you're reporting to Beijing Charlie what not he's saying. I couldn't resist that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Chair, thank you for all the submissions. I just want to make a comment. I mean, I think what looms large, of course, is the transparency requirements in both bills, which seems to have broad support. The transparency provisions obviously require a disclosure every year, but I was wondering whether the committee shouldn't consider, and I'd be interested to hear from members of the public, whether we shouldn't consider, in fact, an additional clause which would compel the PIC to disclose investments within a reasonable period, 30 days or whatever the case may be, over a threshold amount. The problem, of course, is that if particularly large deals are only disclosed annually, and particularly if they're questionable or controversial, we just simply don't know about them. So I think that the committee should give consideration to possibly identifying a threshold amount and requiring the PIC to disclose within 30 days particulars of those investments. It's just a something to think about. But it does seem that the transparency provisions do have broad support, and I presume, Chair, we'll deal with National Treasury and the Government Employees Pension Fund pushback against those transparency provisions a little bit later.
Floyd, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's my job easier when you speak, sorry. Right. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. What I don't know really what is the problem, because I don't know what is the problem, like what is the bigger issue that we're dealing with here. I'll give you context of why I'm saying that is because the Government Employees Pension Fund is the one that is the owners of the money, and then they then deploy those resources to an asset management company, a 100% state-owned asset management company called the Public Investment Corporation. So asset management is a skills-intensive process in terms of what should happen, of like, because you play in the listed companies, and sometimes you have to almost scientifically predict whether some of the investments would make sense or would bring returns in a sustainable and durable way. I agree that workers must be represented in the board of the PIC, but there should be a skill requirement, not only for the worker representatives, but for everyone who serves in the board of the PIC. It must not be that anyone must just say there must be some test of some minimum requirements of people who should serve in the board of the PIC, who can then put other prescriptions of what else should be considered when the board is constituted. But also, we should caution against people who are angry on their own behalf, but they want to portray that as being angry on behalf of workers. GPF said they are happy with the PIC when they came to make a presentation here. In the UIF, like the fund is 2 trillion rands. I think that it grew by about 170 billion rands within a year. And then all of us must be agitated to be angry that no, the PIC is misusing the money of government employees. I don't think that is the case. There was a major loss in the Steinhoff, and because of the criminality of Steinhoff directors and executive management, not because of the investment decisions that were taken by the PIC. And you cannot predict that chain, even if you are a prophet, that someone is going to enter into deals in Germany, buy a company, have some arrangements that will pay you additional money if you make profits, and then doctor the books. You will not know about that. Unless if we say that the PIC must go and literally own and run these companies. I don't think asset management for a pension fund means that you literally should go and run corporations. You check which corporations are doing well in the market. You put money there, you put some oversight mechanisms in terms of broad mechanisms, but not the day-to-day running of the company itself, with the hope that when they declare dividends, they're going to receive your portion and then go to the fund which you're managing. I don't think that some of the judgments that are being placed in the PIC are sensible. They're actually nonsensical. And I'll tell you why I think that they are nonsensical. It's because there is now a growing narrative that seeks to criminalize PIC's efforts in facilitating black inclusion into the economy. Chair, the PIC is literally the only institution that can make sure that black people participate in the economy in South Africa today. Not the IDC. IDC has got long requirements of sureties and this and that and that. But the real ownership of existing capital by black people can meaningfully be facilitated through the public investment corporations. And there's a huge onslaught against that effort because those who are owning the economy now do not want to be joined by any other people. It shows on the actual numbers of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And by and large, whatever you say, like scientifically, you can't argue that the BEE deals that the PIC has invested itself in have collapsed and then it has costed the GPF money. It's not true. It's not scientifically true. It's not mathematically true. You can go and check people who have borrowed money by PIC to go and buy shares into companies. If they've paid that money back, majority of them have paid back that money. They were given loans to buy shares and they paid back that money, majority of them. That is a fact that, but there's a huge narrative to criminalize PIC, by Amabungani, by Tiso Blackstar, people who have got vested interest on the whole question that they tried to look for funding in the PIC, they don't get it, and then they say, no, we're going to rubbish everyone else who is involved there. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe there must be a criteria. Maybe that is what the Amabungani is suggesting, that ANC members must not apply for funding from the PIC. The ANC, unfortunately, has got 60% of voters in South Africa. It's an unfortunate reality. So if you say that those who are associated with the ANC must not apply for the PIC, it's actually like possibly 70% of black people. Because if you exclude white people, the ANC enjoys 70% of black voters. Unfortunately, that is the case now. I don't think that can be a criteria. What should be the criteria is that, is this a sensible business? Can we invest in this business? Are we going to get back our money if we borrow this person to go and buy shares in Capitec, or buy independent media, or buy some oil reserves in Mozambique, or wherever? Are we going to make money as an asset management company? That should be the criteria primarily. So whoever can say what, it's not true that there is a big crisis in terms of what is happening. There are many mechanisms and platforms to question media's partiality or impartiality. So one of the presentations they say is that the PIC funded independent media, and you can see that the quality of journalism in independent media is not up to standard, it's partisan. Is that the criteria of funding a business proposition? Because it's a subjective analysis. I think that the reporting of Bungan is embedded on certain class interests. Right? But I will never say that they must not go and borrow money from any public institution for their business, because there's a section of society that consumes that kind of information that they are selling. It can't be the criteria. You can realize that this is just pure witch hunt and criminalization of efforts, collective efforts to facilitate black people's participation in the economy. And it must be rejected with contempt. I think we must stand firm as Parliament to say that we're not going to be bullied around by some alarmist presentations of what should happen. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to hold the PIC accountable. The PIC must be held accountable. It must disclose information when it is necessary to do so. If the PIC must disclose information and its investment decisions, let us pass a law that all asset managers must do so. Coronation, Investec asset managers, Sanlam asset managers, Old Mutual asset managers, all of them. Because they're managing money of people, of ordinary, it's mutual funds, some of them, which are of ordinary South Africans. We have an obligation as parliament to protect ordinary people. Yes, workers were protecting, but we've got an obligation to protect the policyholders of Old Mutual, of Liberty, of whoever. If we're going to pass rules for an asset manager which is playing in a competitive space, then those rules must apply to all asset managers. It must not be selective. Because some of the things that are being suggested on state-owned entities are meant to sabotage them, that they become less competitive and then allow space for the private sector to play a far much more significant role. We're not going to allow that. It's not going to happen. We're not going to allow for sabotage of public institutions in the name of transparency. We're going to guarantee, we're going to fight corruption, but we're not going to sabotage public institutions by representatives of the white capitalist establishment that wants to continue owning and controlling all South Africa's wealth to the exclusion of black people. I think that is the sentiment that we should take this. Even that suggestion that there must be a non-political chair of the PIC must be rejected. The chairperson of the PIC must be a minister or deputy minister of finance, because that contribution, they come from both government and workers. So that there is political direction given to the public investment corporation. I don't think that we should entertain some of the issues that are being raised here, because we'll fall into a trap of people who just basically want to sabotage an institution which mathematically and in terms of all measures of standards has been doing relatively well compared to all these other financial institutions. Banks have collapsed by themselves, private owned banks. They've even collapsed the world economy. But here is an institution that has survived the world economic crisis, the global economic crisis, has saved workers' money, is at 2 trillion now. It is contributing to inclusion of black people in mainstream economic participation. We must not form part of those that seek to sabotage it. We must reject those who are attempting to do so with contempt. Thank you very much.
Comment?
No, just to explain that this is a public hearing, and so we're not taking any final decision. That's not the way the committee works. What we have here are views of people, and I suppose with the EFS case, because there's only one individual, he can speak for his party. But in the ANC, we're brainstorming. We don't want to preempt the outcome. A public hearing, in our case, is, in our sense, is we hear the public, we think about what you're saying, and then we process the issues. There's going to be many hours of discussion on the issues, so we haven't come to any conclusion. The second thing to say, Tandi Dikeleri, please, because I need to, especially yourselves, because the issues get carried over into study groups. So we haven't taken any decision. The bill, obviously, that the committee has presented is substantially through ANC presentation. The first thing I want to draw attention to, it's a point that Floyd has made, is that you will have to come with very formidable arguments to convince the majority, I think. As I'm saying, it's early stages of my change of view. At this stage, I don't think the majority is going to agree that anybody apart from the minister or deputy minister chairs the board. You have to present very strong arguments, actually. Because ultimately, it's the very taxpayer, the very poor and disadvantaged. Now you've got a VAT increase of 1%. Those taxes are going to be used to bail out the government employees if their pension is not secured. It's a defined benefit, right? So I know Mr. Mania and others feel strongly, and in a different context we would agree that Parliament, we want Parliament to have more power. Increasingly, the ANC itself is far more effective in its oversight role. We've learned the experiences of the last 10 years and more.
So, no, we don't want the executive to have too much power. But in this case, it has to be a politician. It can't be the chair of the finance committee. It has to be the minister of deputy. On that one, at this stage, unless you come with stronger arguments than we've heard, it's very unlikely we're going to agree on that. So you are free, till the very day we vote on this bill, to present us with motivations on why you think, beyond what we've heard so far. That's the sense I have. Notice my words are very carefully chosen, because I want to come back to other issues about Mr. Daniel Machila in a moment. So it's my sense that we're unlikely to agree to that, right? The second thing is, it's interesting that I hope Tabby's listening, right? Because it takes a lot of energy to repeat what I've said here, because people will say, yeah, good, as long as you can multitask like me. Good, right. And I'm older than you, and I've been here long enough to get bored enough to be able to multitask. I'm surprised you are. Now, let me put something else to you, comrades and colleagues. This thing of the unions must respond to this as well. You see, a senior official of Treasury, a senior representative of Treasury, in another context, which some of you are present at, said, if the unions want direct representation on the board of the PIC, then the issues are about conflict of interest. Some people, comrades from the unions and colleagues from the unions, respond to that, that it will undermine the employee-employer relationship. Please respond to that, okay? Fedusa and Kosatu, and anybody else who wants to, and so on. But one of the things this National Treasury representative said was, if the unions persist on this, isn't it time that we looked at changing the nature of the fund from a defined benefit to, what's the other term? Sorry? Yeah, like members of parliament have. Then the unions can do what they want. In that case, maybe you should have an independent chairperson of the board. But we are very unlikely to agree, unless we have stronger evidence on the board being chaired by anybody apart from the minister. What we can do, and that's what we're doing in this bill as I see it, is we're putting in many other provisions now to ensure that the deputy minister or minister are far more accountable to parliament. And if there are other ways in which you can, as civil society here, suggest ways in which we can hold the minister or deputy minister to firmer account, both by the GEPF and the trade unions on the one side, and on the other side, Parliament, please come with such proposals. So the trade-off would be, let's move in the direction of saying, let the minister or deputy minister chair for the reasons we've explained, but let's ensure that we don't trust anybody, not even ourselves, as politicians here. We shouldn't be trusted with such large funds without being accountable. Is there other ways we can make it far more accountable? Right? The third thing to say is, somebody has proposed, I think it's Fedusa, I don't know what members think, but maybe others, we should want a dialogue here. We don't want to, like, a transmission. We'd like it to stay till the end, because Treasury will respond, and we'd like it to respond to them. And anyway, as you know, our committees are open. You can come to any committee meeting, and within a certain latitude, we allow you to speak. And why you should come, Kosatu in particular, Fedusa, because the other bills, who comes here? It's big capital. It's SASA, the insurance industry, it's BASA, where were the trade unions, where were NEHAWO, and so on. So this is not fair. So you have the same rights as everybody else has got to sit in this committee all along, right, till we vote on the bill. Within limits, we'll allow you to speak, right, as decided by the majority. But we've never turned down anybody. You can speak your mind. The next thing to say is, you see, Fedusa is saying that, yes, we can maybe, they're not happy about the investment criteria, Kosatu, but they're saying, I think what we're edging towards saying is the investment criteria should remain in the bill, maybe, but it will be subject to a depositor's mandate as well. That seems to me reasonable. And then who are the depositors? The workers, after all. So, maybe we can look at that possibility. Then, on the issue of asset skills which Floyd raises, actually, Floyd, I think we were edging towards that also in the ANC, but we don't do it explicitly. You were far clearer today than I've been in my own head, and I agree with Floyd for now. Okay? And I hope the answer. You see, he's right. And that will deal with people in Treasury saying, if you want to have the full say, let's change it. So at that point, I've thought about, in fact, in reply to that meeting, when it came up, that actually it's fair what Floyd is saying. Like, can Kosatu think about it and Fedusa? That you don't have to put Becky and Charlie there, or yourself there. Not you, Kosatu, right? Why don't we say union representation, meaning in the broader sense, you choose people who are worker-oriented, in your case, socialist-oriented, and who've got the skills. Like, you know, Neil Coleman brought this wonderful guy on VAT. I saw him on TV the other day. Remember? Very good input, eh? You remember that guy who was like stammered? Very, very good input, eh? Very stimulating. I got two calls from people, Marxists, who told me that a very good input, actually. And I directed the minister's attention to that. So basically what I'm saying is maybe you can choose somebody else. I for now, for what it's worth, I'm speaking for myself, I agree with Floyd that you should not just put anybody there. Right? I mean, with due respect to Dlamini and Charlie, they are not having the skills that you know, Comrade Floyd is speaking about. So I like that, what he said. It was clearer than I've been in my own head. The next thing is, look, man, on PIC and BEE, I defer with Floyd in some respects, but I agree with him in other respects, right? So I think, you know, I would imagine the majority of us would say the PIC is utterly crucial to transforming this economy. In fact, the SACP and COSATU have been raising this since the mid-90s in its critique of GEAR, right? You know that very well, Comrade Matthew. And we feel the PIC is not doing enough to transform. Right? When we talk of transformation, some of us mean, and I think most of us, in a muted sense, the ANC too, it's deracialization and addressing class issues. So the broad thrust of what Floyd is saying, I agree with. But I think he goes too far, in my view. We can agree to disagree on some things. You see, to come to Amabungane and to others here, firstly, I want to say that, but for myself, before I get into trouble, I want to tell you that you've done excellent work overall. Right? You may have unconscious and conscious class biases, but at the end of the day, without Amabungane, this parliament here would not be able to function, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. So I want to thank you for your excellent work overall, right? On many, many things. Commissioner Moyane, you first drew to our attention. On many things, you do outstanding work, right? One would like to see you being more, let's say, representative of the national demographics, but that's a matter you should address. But I think you're too sweeping. You see, I agree with the values that underlie what you're saying and the principles. But if we were a radical social democracy or a real national democratic revolution, which we're not, this is, you know, the ANC parliament, in my view, this is an unfolding national democratic transition. That's what I say. If you want to use global parlance, it's a very conservative social democracy. But it was a left-wing social democracy like Sweden in the 60s or a real national democratic revolution, then of course all this openness and transparency is required. But as Floyd rightly says, and as we're saying on the essay, which is a complete misunderstanding, we have to pass the resolution just now. Sandy, we have to pass that resolution just now. I want to carry the work with it. Okay, I'll wait. Sandy, I'm not going to cover all this ground again. Yeah, you're listening. Yeah, Donna, I want you to hear, because then we have spent hours sitting in your... Sandy has got an office there. She's got an office there near, you know where the speaker is, in the house. I have to go to her office and tell her, hey, this is what we agreed to. Then she tell me, but we didn't, because she's talking to Floyd. Floyd, can you go and sit there, please? In terms of the rules, I can instruct you, Floyd. Can you go and sit on that far end there, where Peggy is? Right, so can we come back to this? Comrades, can we please move fast on this thing? This we're providing, consensually, within the EFF and ANC, some broader position. So we want you to engage within that context to some extent. What we are saying, I'll talk about it. Yeah, but let me finish this thing, because, you see, if, Floyd is right, if we were not in a market economy, and it relates to the SAA thing, why are we going to close only sections? I'm a Bogana, don't write to me, right? It's only sections of a meeting, not a whole meeting, due to market sensitivity, and we're passing that resolution today. You can sit here and see it for yourself. I got a letter from Right to Know yesterday, which completely misunderstands what happened last time. So here it is. We're saying that in a market economy... No, I'm finishing. If you didn't disturb me, I'd have finished by now. Now, here it is. We do not believe the majority... Well, I don't believe that what you're asking for is doable in the current context of a market economy. You're asking for minutes of investment decisions. On that, I really think you don't have a case. I mean, that is, it's like, then why don't you ask Anglo-Americans? Why don't you ask, how do you expect a state-owned company, then go and fight trade and industry and put it into the Companies Act,
You should really be fighting, I didn't know this was your brief, you should be fighting for a Marxist socialist state. Many of the things you say only make sense if you are Marxist, to my view. They can't make sense, only you're radical social democrat, and you're taking an ideological position now. So many of the things you say, I agree in values and principles, is premature. No, I don't think investment decisions, minutes of investment decisions, then you must require it of everybody else. I also think what Floyd is saying is correct. In a market economy, you lose some and you win some. Even the private sector asset managers. In the black economic emerging sector, it's likely you possibly, in the current context, with the high levels of monopoly and the racial past we've had, it is harder for African people to succeed in this economy. There'll probably be a disproportionately higher failure with investments where African people are owners or blacks more generally. And I agree with Floyd on most of those things, right? So what I'm saying in short is, you know what, it's too sweeping. Also, the second speaker, I mean, I think, did you really have to say that about Iqbal's survey? And it's really not relevant to the issues here. It's like you're settling scores within the media industry. I can talk to you outside about what I think about independent news. It's not relevant to the ANC. I can tell you what I think, but it's not really relevant here. There are a whole lot of other things I want to say, but there are some things that I think are clear. One, it's extremely unlikely this committee, unless it's first off, will agree that the deputy minister or minister shouldn't chair. Two, it's extremely unlikely that we will agree that minutes of investment decisions are made available. You must tell us why. Why in this free market economy? Three, it's a very good point that Floyd has put, in my view, and I think most of us, that you shouldn't just nominate your president or general secretary, but somebody who's got asset skills and so on. And decisions are made off the hoof. And sometimes you make the wrong decisions. But as Floyd rightly says, that is not to say the PIC shouldn't be more accountable. Next week we're going to deal with them again about all these issues in the public domain, thanks to you, the media. About now, for example, there's one thing you said I didn't know about. Hands up those who knew. What fees you say I exchanged? I don't know about this. And if that is happening, then we need an answer. Next week, Tuesday. When they come in Tuesday? Is it Tuesday? Maybe a next week, Tuesday or Wednesday, right? They must answer what fees. That question, Cindy, where's Cindy? Just tell them I don't know what fees. You can maybe answer today. There are many other things here, but I'll stop now. Tell me.
I asked you to speak
before me and you didn't.
Yeah, Chair, I need to say this upfront. You see, the developmental agenda of the African National Congress is very clear. I'm not in a political school. If I was in the political school, I was going to give an ideological context of what the ANC stands for, and I will not dampen what we call the National Democratic Revolution, so I will not be apologetic about that one. The mandate as public representatives representing the ANC is very clear on where we stand about our developmental agenda. And we know it better than anybody what is economic, radical economic transformation. So we don't need anybody to interpret it on our behalf. So that mandate is no good. It's not interchangeable. We are not going to exchange it for anything else. What I always remind people when I sit here is that economic transformation is not going to be served on a platter, because freedom itself was never served on a platter. So we're not going to be apologetic as black people in terms of our participation in the economy. I'm not going to go into town about that. I need a day and a half to explain myself on that one. I'm going to limit my engagement on issues that are before the table. And Floyd has been very articulate. You see, sometimes when you sit and listen to him, you become very proud that the ANC has not faltered. That the ANC has not faltered. The ANC has not faltered. No. It's only when he becomes a delinquent that I remind him that he's young. But the rest is very clear. Now let's go here and explain to the presenters. Other matters will go into regulations. Other matters will go into the legislation. So those matters that needs to be dealt with through regulations will not be legislated. And we'll separate them as and when we engage finally on the bill. You'll be here, we'll take you through. That other matters are not a matter of legislation. And we will also remind to separate matters who are in the principal act that must not be brought through the window, and look at the amendments that we're dealing with. So if we have to engage on matters of the principal act, there's a different platform to do that. So we're also not going to compromise on those ones. We are also not going to compromise on union representation, but we are very clear. Comrade Nati put it into perspective. that it can't just be in the numbers. It's relevant and substantive numbers that are going to make an impact. Even on that one, we don't need a study group for that one. We understand what we want to achieve, because we're avoiding the very same failures of corruption. Because corruption is not only happening through government, it can also happen through the workers. So we are not going to be interchangeable about that. The ANC is going to be very clear. And I know I speak on behalf of the majority of ANC members who are here. Probably the children of the ANC also. I want you, Fedusa, to be clear what you mean by major depositors. Because once you say major depositors, it's like there are other depositors we are excluding. So depositors are depositors. So we need to consult on directives to depositors, but be clear it's on depositors. So once you say major, it means there's an exclusion. Chair, the union movement will be here when we announce as the committee that indeed the deputy minister is going to be the chairperson of the board. Thank you.
Anything else, Nati? You put your hand up, you're not sure. Or you can come in whenever you want. You've got 2 minutes, you're leaving at 11:30. You don't want to raise it quickly.
It's almost 11:30 now. So I I've been reflecting on this thing about should it be the minister or deputy minister chairing and so on. I think let's just settle on that one. That can't be entertained. Yeah, let's settle on that thing. I respect views that also differ from this one and so on. But let's settle on that one. You see, my suspicion, that view is largely premised on a broader sweeping statement. We're all corrupt. It's premised on that. Now, and I have a problem with that kind of approach, for an example. You know, Africans and black people in general in this country, all of them were branded as criminals, all of them. Now, I know of this thing as an 11-year-old boy, for instance, when I was working in some people's gardens and so forth. You always had to justify your existence there because you are a criminal. And it was, openly stated so and so forth. Now, that's a subjective view. That's really a subjective view, and I don't think we should entertain it and so forth. Where in the world have you ever heard of an institution such as this, for an example, where government is completely somewhat detached from it, and for that matter, the executive power of government is taken away because we seem to think that that enhances a democratic outlook. What kind of democratic outlook is that? And so on. So I accept and agree with you on the question, we should be convinced severely on the question why a minister and a deputy minister shouldn't be the chair of a board, for an example. Yes, I think you're being magnanimous, really, but I think for me the issue is settled. That thing can be entertained. It's just a no-no. Precisely because I think what is the motivating factor behind it is that there is this branding, we're all corrupt. And so then I can't accept that.
Okay. Look, you can see the strength of feeling on the minister or deputy minister being there. But also there are processes of the committee. In a public hearing, you don't take final decisions. It's never happened like this before. But the fact that it's happened shows you the depth of feeling. So it's still your right. As a chair, I have to say this, because we can't treat this hearing any different from any others we had over the last 4 years. You can still make motivations, but the likelihood of convincing people is very remote for the reasons set out. And there are many other reasons too, three of which I can think of, but let's pass on. So on that one, you're free up to the last day to say what you want, but you'll have to really come up with something unfathomable at this stage. Okay, over then to Kosato.
All right, thanks, Chair, and I'll try to couple the key issues comments members raised. Yes, Chair, look, we've already briefed Comrade Becky on the former TNG General Secretary's stance. It's unfortunate Comrade Nati had to leave. But maybe we'll send him an email. Look, Chair, I think of the easy part, the issue of who should chair the board. Look, we had a very heated discussion in this COSATU with our affiliates around it. We were quite worried last year. But look, last year's a different era. And we know that who chairs the board is not a magic wand. Just because you have a non-minister like SAA, you can have a chairperson collapse that entity. I think for us, the key issue is the checks and balances, the transparency, the accountability. I think we're quite happy with the SCOF bill, which said that ministerial directive should be tabled before the shareholders, before parliament, be transparent. So that's a good check and balance. And look, I think we agree ideologically with our comments across the aisle that the PSC has got a very key developmental transformative role in the economy. And of course, you know, the state being the guarantor of the GPF, the UF, etc., it has a vested interest. So from our point, Chair, we are fine with the Minister or Deputy Minister of Finance chairing it. And we're happy with the provisions in the bill which put check and balance. I think that's a fair and a key approach. Chair, look, in terms of union representation, and I think both yourself and Honorable Shibambo raised it, we would support the issue of requirements, that you don't just take myself as a sloganeer to sit on the PIC board, but you have set requirements for all the board members, all of the members. And asset investment expertise, anything, 100% will support you, because look, again, we don't want to have Comrade Eunice, because we like him, sitting there and Eunice collapses the PIC.
And I will.
Sure. So I think, Chair, the more requirements which are logical, et cetera, the better. Because if the PIC collapses, Chair, we can close the country, we can call in the IMF. And it'll affect everybody, no one will be left untouched. Chair, look, the issue of union representation, and look, there's been a heated debate inside us, even on the issue of the conflicts of interest and all that. I think a conflict of interest, look, all of us would have a conflict of interest. Even my wife works for Woolworths, and PIC is a big shareholder at Woolworths. But I think what we should do there is to have very strong checks and balances on the code of conduct for board members. If you have a vested interest because I'm investing in a shopping center, I want PIC, disclose it, recuse yourself, and I think the more transparency, the requirements, the better. But Chair, look, first, the issue of union representation is a very hot grenade for COSATU members. They're angry, to put it in the politest in terms of how government has behaved over the past 10 years. So we're also battling to keep our members' faith on board. For them, we know the union representation is not a magic wand. Comments can still be corrupt, they can be bought off. But it's one further tool to help provide transparency, accountability, etc. We feel keen, Chair, that it shouldn't be one union rep because it's easy to bribe one person. And it's also open to abuse if a minister appoints one union rep. That's why we prefer the committee wording, say 2 to 3, chosen by the PSCBC. We're fine even with Fiducia's proposed wording, the three largest affiliates in the PSCBC, that's fine. But it's the principle that it's the unions which choose, not Comrade Eunice because he likes this one, he knows this union members, easy to manage, etc., etc. Chair, look, I think the code of conduct would apply to all persons, even government. We think government should play an active supervision role around the PIC. That's why we welcome Treasury's representation there. I think we would disagree with Comrade Tleko about this kind of whole argument about unions wanting to co-govern. There are examples, good examples internationally, in Japan, in Germany, even in the private sector where unions sit in the boards of companies. And it helps to minimize the trust deficits, helps to bring everybody together to manage things properly. It builds trust. But we know it's not a magic wand. It's just one tool in the fight against corruption. I think to Honorable Mania around the disclosures, we think that's a good discussion, and we think it's something good food for thought. It should be reasonable because you don't expect the PIC to be reporting every 5 seconds and do nothing else. But you could have maybe in the regulations some kind of criteria. Some stuff could be an annual report. Some things which are large could be a quarterly report, something which is manageable. But the more transparency provisions, the better. Chair, look, I think also to latch on to Honorable Shivamu, look, by and large, we're happy with the rate of return the PIC has done. We think they've done a good job overall. But we don't think we shouldn't err on the side of caution, given the extent of corruption in the state and the society, private sector at large. I must also say, Chair, we do have reps who sit in the GPF, the UAF, the quota boards, and they've raised frustration with us that they feel they're not getting enough feedback from the PIC. They have to chase at times. So we know, again, the more check and balances, the better we have. We can assist each other. We would support Honorable Shivambu 200% if he's drafted a bill applying similar rules to asset management in the private sector. I think the Fidentia issue, Steinhoff issue, is a case in point. I think, Chair, to your issues, I think some of them I've already dealt with. But yeah, I think, Chair, if we're going to mention the examples of the quota and how unions allowed quota to be messed up, we could also say how union reps on the UAF board also helped to turn it around from being in the red to being in the black. Not that we are perfect, but yeah, it's a two-way street. Chair, I think in terms of the issue Fiducia raised around the investment mandate, look, we feel very strongly that the committee provisions for investment mandate are fantastic. They should be retained. We don't think they're too restrictive on the PIC's operational requirements and so on. We would be happy to add the Fiducia proposal of saying including any mandate given by the depositors. We think that's a fair, reasonable offer. And I think, Chair, look, we think the wording in the committee bill is fairly broad enough to protect the market sensitivity that I think yourselves have raised. Purchasing of shares, et cetera, et cetera. We're fine with the issue you raised on minutes. I think lastly, Chair, just honorable to the whip, honorable Tobias, we agree with you. Some things must go in the regulations. Some things are already in the bill. It's fine. I think, Chair, we've responded to all the issues. Thanks, Chair.
Some things go in the MOI or articles. Quick question is, I'm not sure if you answer this, do you think that the minutes of investment decisions should be made public?
So, look, I think we were persuaded by your argument that you don't need to disclose everything. Maybe perhaps you could find a mechanism that if you really think there's serious issues of corruption, you could be a bit more specific. We are sensitive to the needs of the PIC for confidentiality, sensitivity. Maybe perhaps there's something to further engage around to check what's the right balance. Because you need to get the right balance before preventing corruption, but also protecting the PIC's operational efficiency, etc.
But the issue of corruption must be tackled vigorously in our report to Parliament to make that clear. We cannot. This is public money. You know, I mean, even more than Steinhoff. Well, Steinhoff has implications to the public sector employees. But we must tackle corruption vigorously. I think in our report, Frank, we must say that. But releasing investment decisions, it can only be relevant to some specific legitimate allegation of corruption where the committee is convinced there's a case there. Right? And so the criteria, those things, I don't think you can spell out in law in that specific way, but we can look at that. Okay, over to Fiducia.
Thank you, Chair. I'll begin with the last part. Just to add to what you said, we agree on your comments made about the invest minutes, and also that obviously when it's need to be because of allegations, then so be it. But we also believe, and that links to our position on the investment mandate. If there's a firm investment mandate, and that investment mandate is subject to oversight, then it will eliminate the need to have investment minutes, because you can measure those investments against the investment mandate. And the PIC board and the PIC itself can be held accountable if they deviate without good cause or reason from the provided mandate. That is why we are so strong and firm on the investment mandate. That investment mandate obviously should come from the depositors, of which the GEPF is a major depositor. And the GEPF have got its obligations in terms of reporting and their decisions. So we are quite comfortable with a firm mandate that will not be necessary. And that actually now deals with our point on the depositors mandate, which was asked. The issue on major depositor, we agree with the point made that it should be clarified as to whom are major depositors and what about the rest, and how will we accommodate everybody in terms of decisions on the board to accommodate all the depositors and not making the PIC the tool for only one single entity. That is for us also very important. The point on the chairperson of the board, I've taken note of your invitation. I will take it back to my principals, and we will submit further motivation before your final vote on this, on the bill, if need be. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Next, Abu Mugani.
Right, just to answer quickly to the accusation that has been thrown at us. Mr. Shivambu, we are a small non-profit organization. We certainly don't have interests such as Tiso Black Star, for example, does, loans from PIC or investments from PIC. We rely on the public for the majority of, or the biggest share of our income, of our survival. Also to make it clear that our job as investigative journalists is the same as journalists the world over. We look for chinks in the armor. If we look for chinks in the armor, if we look for problems in the way that public duties are exercised, we do that not because we're trying to undermine this or that. We are doing it simply because that's what investigative journalists do and what they should do. That's an important role, the watchdog role that should be fulfilled in a democracy. So from that flows transparency. Transparency is what enables the watchdog role. And that is why we've come here to argue for greater transparency provisions than what you currently have in the proposals. Now, to make it clear, again, transparency is not an antidote to empowerment. Transparency is an antidote to corruption and abuse of power. It is an antidote to where legitimate expectations of all South Africans, and in particular state pensioners, is concerned. So to answer to the specific issue about where the minutes should be disclosed, first I need to remind you that our proposals go well beyond just the minutes issue. Our proposals are about more transparency in the board appointment process and also in the existing disclosure provisions, how to strengthen those. And there, what we are looking at, what we would recommend, is that classes of information to be disclosed annually, that is definitely written into the regulations. We realize that is a regulation issue. And also to make sure that the regulating process is something that happens with greater oversight of Parliament. We do realize that disclosure of minutes is quite a radical ask, and maybe some of us are quite red at heart. We certainly dream from time to time, and it may be that in this case we've done that, but certainly we, in recognition of the potential pushback, we are not asking for minutes to be disclosed without any hedging. What we are proposing, again, if you look at especially our written submissions, is that there are safeguards both in both directions. So, for example, minutes should not be disclosed before a certain period of time after the investment decision, so that market outcomes cannot be distorted. And again, commercially sensitive information, we're not asking for that to be disclosed, for it to be redacted if possible, otherwise it may be refused, subject to an overriding public interest. The overriding interest, public interest, who will decide that? I think the jurisprudence around that is abundantly clear. That is something where the ask comes from the person who applies. The refusal or permission, that comes from the person from the PIC in this case. They decide whether they agree that there's an overriding public interest. Of course, that decision is then reviewable in a court of law. So ultimately, the decision may lie with the judge. Thank you.
I think really this is an ongoing discussion. Can we move to Treasury then, if it's agreeable? Anybody wants to say? Yeah, sure.
And the GPM are not going to be given a chance to say.
Yeah, I think what they've done, right,
is you're representing PIC, GPF, and Treasury, right? It's an overall.
PIC and GPF, I think, is a good way to
make a submission. Alan, is that right? They didn't request you. So, I mean, I know you've been engaging with them. And I think they'll be here all the time. So, if they want to say something, Daniel, you're free to say, but you didn't request specifically, right? And I know you've been conferring with PIC and GEPFMP, right? But they are free to speak then. Good? Okay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We're going to speak to our ministers later. We don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I was just told also with the first... Sorry, I'm sitting a bit forward. I'm going to use the minister's letter, which contains our comments on the two bills. The first one deals with the mandate of the PIC, and that's a proposed amendment to clause 2 about the investment criteria proposal. Now, firstly, the provision stipulates that investments must be made in accordance with the depositors' instructions, which I think is good that it's now included in the Act, even though I think that's been the practice of the PIC. The concern that we have with the investment criteria is that it may not necessarily coincide with the instruction from the depositor. So I think, Chair, you mentioned that if one makes that subject to, in case there's a potential conflict, all must clarify what means take into account in the context of the bill. So that's the issue we raise, because in the end of the day, this is money of in the case of the GPF, members' money, pensioners, UIF, they must invest money according to their instructions. And then also just to mention, there is a specific provision in the Act that deals with investments of deposits at Section 10, and that may be the maybe a better place to include everything related to the investment provisions of the PIC. Then the second issue that we raised is related to this. There is a clause in the bill which indicates that the PIC must, when investing funds on behalf of depositors, invest in projects that will benefit members of the depositors. Now, the obligation to ensure that they act in accordance with mandate, that will come from the instruction from the depositors. So I don't think there's a need to stipulate this, because the PIC must act according to the instructions from the client or the asset manager, asset owner, sorry. And then also in the context, the UIF and the compensation fund, I don't think necessarily you can say they have members as such, the compensation fund in particular. Then the other comment we have is also in relation to clause 4 of the committee bill, and that deals with the financing of buying of property by members of the GPF. And the clause doesn't identify the source of the funding, which I assume it was meant to be funds from the GPF, but of course not all the funds of the that's invested to the PIC comes from the GPF. Now, such an instruction always should come from the GPF in their mandate, and it must, if required, the GPF law or the rules must be amended accordingly. And this should not be something that should be in the PIC Act. Then on the board composition, regarding the proposal that the minister or the deputy minister should be the chairperson of the board, that would be written into the Act, the current Act in the MOI doesn't stipulate who is to be the chairperson. It's left to the minister to appoint a chairperson and deputy chairperson. The one difficulty with having the minister as the chairperson is the minister is the executive authority of the PIC, and the minister is also representing the state as the sole shareholder. Now, in terms of the PFMA, the board is the accounting authority. So now, if you make the minister the chairperson, then the minister is going to chair that authority. They can be involved in all kinds of operations with the PIC, which I think will definitely cause difficulties. The deputy minister, there's not a problem in that regard, so the deputy minister could be the chairperson. But just to say that in such instance, even though it's practice to appoint an independent deputy chairperson, maybe that should be written into the Act to make sure that there's an independent person on the board, even though the other members would be, but the deputy chairperson is obviously plays a more important role. Then, in both the private members' board and the committee board, there's a proposal that there should be 10 non-executive members and 2 non-executive members. We are proposing that the numbers rather be left to the MOI, or if not, that allowance be made for more, no less and no more than 15 members. And the main reason is that they need adequate numbers of people to sit on the different committees of the board, especially given the investment function of the PIC. Then also, should the number of non-executive members is specified in the Act, it's proposed that only the CEO be identified, because currently it's also proposed that the CFO should be sit on the board, that rather be left to the MII or to the minister to decide who should be the other executive member on the board. It was discussed earlier, the issue of qualifications of board members. There is a current provision in the Act in Section 6.3 that sets out qualifications for all members of the board, which would apply should trade union representatives also be appointed. And in our submission on the 19th of April, we also proposed an expansion of that definition to use some of the language from King 4. In relation to the board. Then as to the private members' board proposes a parliamentary process for the appointment of board members, the committee bill doesn't contain such a provision and provides, like in the current Act, that the minister appoints in consultation with cabinet. We support the current arrangement and as also in the committee bill that it should be the minister in consultation with cabinet. Then, as the specific non-executive members mentioned in the private members and committee bill, the proposal of a national treasury representative is supported, and also each major depositor. We have a similar question. It's not clear what's a major depositor, because if you look at it, it could only be the GPEF if you consider the current funding or investment by the GPEF. Then, as the proposal from the committee bill on the union representation, about 2 to 3 members, I think the language must just be clear that it's not just from one union, and we support that it should be 2 or 3 union representatives nominated from registered units represented in a PCBC. The next area is ministerial directives. Now, the Act provides that the minister may issue directives on the management of the PIC. Now, and the proposal is that these be tabled in the National Assembly and before depositors and also be published on the PIC website. Now, that is supported. And then there's also in the committee will a provision that these directives must be based on the investment criteria that's proposed early in the bill. I think one question one should look at, if in the context, does management of the PIC not simply means day-to-day operations and not the investment decisions of the PIC? And if that's the intention, maybe the provision should say that, and in that case, then a reference to the investment criteria won't be necessary. So it'd be simply on the operations of the PIC that the minister may issue directives. Then on the disclosure of investments, I think this was also highlighted in the earlier presentation. Now the proposal in both bills are that there should be a report reflecting listed and unlisted investments, that should be done annually and disclosed as indicated. Now, in the submission that we made in April, we said closure should happen, but only with the consent of the positives. Now, a question I think that remains in our mind is that the whole, whether investment decisions or how investments are made or where it's invested, should that not be dealt with by the depositor, or the requirements in that regard should be placed on the depositor instead of on the PIC, who is merely acting on the mandate of a depositor. Now, if the provision is retained in the bill, it is proposed that it be subjected to the client's consent or the depositor's consent, and that it should be limited to unlisted investments for the following reasons. Now, just to give an example of the GPF, now, the GPF discloses already certain unlisted investments in their annual report, and then important also in terms of time, the GPF is not subject to the PFMA, and as such, they do not table the annual report, and they normally only table the report around October, so one just has to look at the timing if one includes this provision. Now, the PIC has not disclosed listed investment information, that's the information that we were provided. Now, shareholders of listed companies are publicly available information, and major shareholders are also listed in companies' annual reports, as well as on their websites. Now, when the PIC disclosed unlisted investment information in the past, it obtained the client's approval, and then in 2016, they also consulted the Financial Services Board to ensure that they don't contravene the provisions of the FIS legislation, in particular in relation to confidential information, because otherwise they risk the withdrawal of their financial services provider license, which is the main tool under which the PIC operates apart from the legislation. Now, the PIC also indicated in the first year they also obtained the consent of all of the affected unlisted companies. But now they have a contractual provision in place which enable them to disclose the information without first obtaining these companies in which they invest. Now, as to the question of the disclosure of listed investments, now the reason we're not supporting it is because it can influence the market. Other investors can very easily see what positions the PIC is taking. And therefore influence the market, and that is risky given that it's the largest investment invested on the JSE. Hopefully my colleagues from the PIC will add if they want to this particular point, because I know this is probably the most critical one in terms of our presentation. Thank you, Chairperson.
PIC, want to add anything? And
thank you, Chair. I can't understand why, after 2 years of making full disclosures in respect of unlisted investments, the National Treasury and presumably the Government Employees Pension Fund and the PIC are now rolling back on that objective. My crisp question is, I mean, does National Treasury accept that the effect of their proposal for depositors to disclose would have two effects? The first is it would limit the disclosure. The Government Employees Pension Fund does disclose information, but it discloses limited information about a limited number of investments. That's the first point. It would also have the effect of reducing accountability, in my view, because the Government Employees Pension Fund's annual report is only tabled in October and sometimes later, after the PIC's annual report and presumably the annual hearing on the PIC. So it would limit or reduce and possibly have the effect of frustrating accountability of the PIC. I wonder what your comment is on those two factors. Then also,
you correctly point out that up until now, information about unlisted investments has been disclosed, and you now are concerned about disclosure of listed investments. In your presentation, you say correctly that information about listed investments is publicly available, and yet you are concerned about the disclosure of the information that appears to be, that you already admit is publicly available, and you're concerned that it might affect market conditions. I know that you asked if the PIC would comment on that, and I'd appreciate it if they would comment on that, so that we properly understand the point that you are trying to make. It's not clear in your presentation.
Colleagues, comments?
No?
Right.
Chair, just before they respond, because I'd like them just to consider that as well. Tom Bugani, in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, I know they've used it before to get information, but shouldn't Section 46 of that Act give them what they want? Because that deals with overriding any kind of justification you have for not disclosing information if that information relates to a crime that's going to be committed or a law that's broken, and there's some stuff about environmental protection as well, international treasury. The issue of the minister not being able to chair the board because the board is also the accounting authority. The minister has the power in terms of Section 49(3) of the PFMA to appoint a different person as the accounting authority of a public entity in exceptional circumstances, and maybe that can address that question. I would just like their responses, Chair. Thanks for the opportunity.
Anything else? Yeah, of course.
Just to add to my point about the sequencing of these disclosures, it's not unimportant, because in 2017, although there was a full disclosure, that disclosure was in fact made directly after the Finance Committee meeting on the PIC's annual report. So the Finance Committee members did not have the benefit of being able to carefully scrutinize those investments ahead of the meeting and then pose questions to the PIC. So the sequencing is not unimportant.
Okay.
PIC. Just on the listed investments, our concern with the listed investments is if we put all the listed investments out there, let me use an example. Say the 1 year when we publish it, we are the top shareholders, the top shares holdings are in banks. I'm just using an example, the lowest one in mines. The next year we publish it, the top shareholding is in mining and the lowest one in banks. The newspaper headline is going to be PIC lost confidence in banks or something like that. So we just, that information is available. Companies can be approached for that information. It is available. But we just worried that we might paint a picture that we don't want to paint by putting that out.
Mugane, do you want to reply to Frank Jenkins, the advocate, saying that you are covered? Section 46, right?
That is right. PIAB does provide that public override, and that would be our fallback position. PIA, in our experience, though, is cumbersome. It has long time periods. So what we were hoping for is something that makes disclosure more accessible by rote without cumbersome procedures.
Okay. Can I raise something else, colleagues? You see, we had mandated...
You see, it's very interesting that disclosure is not on the basis of any investigation on wrongdoing. It's just a blanket approach on sensitive investment issues. This is not just disclosure. These are investment matters. You don't just put them there because there's competitors, there's other role play. So and there's a fallback position. So there's no clarity as to, in this context, what does Amabungani mean? Wanting disclosure when there is a fallback position of PIAB. So we need to be very clear on what you're trying to achieve here, because that's what creates a very blurred impression that you might be representing others.
Over to you.
Right, I think the kind of society that we possibly dream of, again with possibly reddish hearts, would be one where, such as in Sweden, where really just about any government documentation is there for the asking and in fact quite easily available. So this is possible. And there's no accusation of wrongdoing if one says that information should be easily available. I think this is the kind of transparent and participatory democracy that we all believe in. Thanks.
Chair, the question is, we have got a mechanism to gain the access to that information now. Why do you want to put it in the law of the PIC? Because you can gain access to information that you need from the PIC through existing legislation. Why do you want us to make it a law in the PIC that you want to gain access to information when you can do that now?
No, I like the response because then it put into context what is the thinking behind. You see, the difficulty here when we believe in international standards and principles, right? But not all international standards and principles apply in all countries. This is a developmental state with its unique features, with its unique history. So once you juxtapose it with a stable country that was, I mean, Sweden after the World War and Denmark were the first country to industrialize and they've been leading everything. This is South Africa, where the majority are poor, the minority are rich. And those who are the majority are black and those who are in minority are rich are white. And there's interest that government is trying to address here. It's a developmental state, it's trying to create a balance. And you compare it with a stable country that does not have the same features as South Africa. That's the problem. So it's not intended to hide. We're not introducing a secrecy clause that says SOEs, as and when these transact, they must not disclose. And to legislate on the basis of a particular experience, it's also limiting. If there was corruption at one stage, doesn't mean tomorrow there will be corruption in the same institution, especially when you strengthen your transparency clause. You see, so you need to be very careful that it's not an emotional engagement on a very important issue where we need to be rational about how we do it.
Right, again, I sense that there is a kind of a juxtaposition here of transparency and corruption, that the one implies the other. I think again, that transparency is a mechanism that is good for any kind of society, and I can't really add to that. I don't think one should make any assumptions about what transparency is aimed to achieve. It is not there to take away power from the executive. It is not there to take away power from competent managers to do their job. It is not there to prevent BEE. It is simply there to ensure that the public, who are the ultimate stakeholders in this entire process, that they have access to the process. Thank you.
Well, it could be argued...
You see, no, it's fine. I understand the thinking. You see, the difference between people who think about reporting on transparency and those who deal with investment is two different things. You see, because we have people who want information. There are people who are handling competitive and sensitive information. That's why we need to be very clear about what we're dealing with. That's why you have a fallback that gives you a satisfactory environment as and when there's a suspicion that corruption has taken place. But for you to want to disclose what can be detrimental for your own survival as a business, it's a problem. So sometimes we need to debate from a level of the same understanding of what we're dealing with, because then it helps to understand how you deal with these issues. And he makes an example that you reported this year that you had more shares in mining and not necessarily in banks, and the next fiscal year you report differently, it becomes, because there's investor sentiment also that needs to be taken into account. In most cases, how the media reports affects investor sentiment. I can make an example of an article that was written yesterday, totally different from what transpired, and it can give a different investor sentiment. Because of the caption, I would not want to expose media now. I'm just making an example. I can do that, but I don't want to do that. I'm saying how the media even reports heading just, you know, bring shares down, just one heading. So we need to be able to up the ante in terms of what we understand about what we're dealing with.
Chair, I just want to once and for all understand where Dr. Dan Machila stands on the issue of transparency. For 2 years, the PIC has disclosed its unlisted investments, and it's done so willingly. My impression now is that there is a rollback, and that the PIC are now not willing to disclose. I mean, I wonder if he would just make a statement on this matter. Where exactly does he and the PIC stand?
Whether he or his colleague does that again, or they're from PIC, but it's fine. Floyd?
No, Chair, I think he's grandstanding now, but and I think we should take note that there's a narrative that is being built around the PIC without tangible issues. Maybe when we meet on Monday, we'll then be able to entertain all of these issues one by one, in terms of the allegations and everything else there. If there are issues that people want to raise in the PIC, let's get to hear that presentation and then deal with those issues on a case-by-case basis, because some of the submissions that are being made here, like, it's opportunism, it's trying to build a case that there is a crisis and that there must be suspension of the CEO of the PIC and all of those things. And it's because, and that the origins of that is people who have invested interest in the PIC. It's not people who generally want transparency. It's people who have invested interest. Either they asked for money they didn't get, or certain deals that they wanted to be funded by the PIC were not approved, whatever thing. And then they utilize media spaces which they own and media institutions which they control to then build the, and then and co-opt political parties as well to then build a narrative to suit their agenda. And I think we should be aware of that, that is the whole situation. Because the PIC must be held accountable. The GPF says that the information about listed investments is publicly available. The unlisted investments is available to us, all of us. No, all of us. Amabungani can go and get the whole list of everything else there and then come and say, we think that there's corruption here, there. And if there's corruption, these systems to deal with corruption will act, all of us, decisively against corruption, expose it and then deal with it. But to just drive a public narrative that it's a huge crisis and everything else without sound basis is opportunistic, that must be rejected with contempt.
Bungana, can you reply, and then Daniel Machile or his colleague? You're a Dan, both are, is it? You're also a Dan. Dion, okay.
Right, I think the only unanswered question at this point is really about the PIA protection that there is, the 46, Section 46 protection. Now again, just to emphasize, I think what we are simply proposing is a mechanism to make the culture of disclosure a little bit more proactive. What Section 46 does in practice is to give an answer after a court battle 3 years later. Thank you.
A few quick things. Firstly, to civil society, look, when you make sweeping statements, right, and provocative ones, or robust ones, you'll get a robust reply. So I think take this in the spirit of a robust exchange. And that's what our democracy is, an angry, volatile, but very aggressive democracy. So it's part of our political culture, right? And I think that people have a right to suggest that you have either conscious or unconscious class and other imperatives. That's their right. As a chair, I can't rule it out. But it's not the collective view of this committee that necessarily what every member says is correct. And we haven't taken a decision. So people should feel free to come to Parliament. And our aim is not collectively, at least, to impute any nefarious objective. Otherwise, people won't come to Parliament, right? So I don't think that's the spirit in which you should understand it, right? And you know the individuals who speak here, and you know their style and their temperament and how they see things. But it's their right. It's an open democracy. You talk of transparency, right? Then you must be hoist by your own petard. People would rather speak to you the way they do. But that is not to say, you know, we want people not, we're not going to constantly question people's credibility and legitimacy and so on. Personally, I think you've done a lot of good work. You get it wrong at times, in my view, but without you, neither the ANC, actually, not the ANC, not the government, not Parliament, not civil society would be able to do things. You've revealed some stunning things, which I'm sure Floyd will agree, even the EFF has used to advance the case, and they found that actually what you've been saying is correct. So you do very good work. But I want to say something from my own side. We're talking past each other. Basically, you see, when they asked the great Oliver Tambo in the late 80s, as we're edging towards a negotiated democracy, what sort of South Africa would you like? So he said, well, it's there in the Freedom Charter. The journalist said, no, 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 but that's it, not broad. What is it? He said, well, the closest we can think of is Sweden. Sweden's social democracy, he said. Because people don't understand globally what national democratic revolution means. Global politics is social democracy. What I would say is left-wing social democracy. But you see, Tandy is right, and I think Floyd's saying the same thing. What you're not bearing in mind is that we have a huge inequality problem in this country. I mean, according to the statistics, we're the most unequal society in the world, okay? And worse, it's racially defined, largely. Okay, there are the Patrick Motsepe's and so on, and the president's done very well in the market. But for the most part, it's Africans overwhelmingly who are denied. And if we don't settle that, and blacks, but mostly Africans, and I think so-called coloreds also, you know. When we talk, that's why I like using the word blacks. I've always said, yeah, but I mean, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, Indian people have done fine overall, right? But coloreds are always marginalized also, you know. If we forget them, it's because African and black. But actually, let's leave all that aside. I'm saying to you, my brother, I think you are just wrong in what I call a fundamentalism about transparency without taking national context into account. You see, at the end of the day, you present yourself as representing the public, which means primarily the African majority, right, and the poor and disadvantaged. But it's not in the interest of the African majority and the poor and disadvantaged for every little detail that the PIC effects in way of action to be out there in the public domain. The example Dion has given is a good example, Tandy. It's a good example, right? Look how the media operates. It would not be wise. So on the matter of, I think you are right, David, Mr. Mania, to raise those questions. What has happened that you retreated? Your previous deputy minister allowed it, right? So you should reply to that. But on the whole, given that we're in a market economy, there are limits, I think, to what the PIC can do in terms of minutes that you want, limits. And I'm not sure at the moment what the collective decision of this meeting is. We must think more carefully about wanting openness and transparency, but not at the expense of the working class and the poor. And we need to find some way of it. But on the other hand, all of us are utterly clear, starting next Tuesday, right? It was meant to take place today. But the deputy minister is out of the country. We've sent a notice yesterday. We want him here on Tuesday. And if you can't make Tuesday, it'll be Wednesday, Dan. I need to speak to you about the practicalities. You have to be here to answer all those issues. Right? We've sent an email to you yesterday, right? To your office. So we will be discussing that. We, in fact, if any organization has been before this committee over the last 9 months, I think you'll be correct. It's the PIC that's been here most. So we will tackle corruption. And we want transparency, but not at the expense of the developmental goals and the interests of the working class and the poor. Can we have this debate outside? Maybe we can have some tea. I'd like to engage with you. I'll give you my cell number. Outside this meeting, we're talking past each other. The values and principles that underpin you actually belong to the ANC. We wanted this radical democracy. We wanted openness and transparency. We took this constitution for that reason partly. We wanted it, but then we realized the reality of what we're living with, and we have to tweak it. Sweden could do it. Do it because it's Sweden, Sweden, right? But there are many things that Sweden does that next door, okay, outside of Scandinavia, the Germans don't do. And next door, the Italians do even less, right? So we can debate that outside. But lastly, I'm saying yes to transparency, no to corruption, yes to actually ensuring that you're effective in the market. Because otherwise, if the PIC goes, we're all finished, right? So the next thing is we asked MP, mandated by the study group and the majority in this committee, we asked for the DM to be the board chair. But you've given us another reason why it can't be the minister. And I really think, with due respect to you, Frank, when I raised that with you, you gave the same argument. I said, but why have you put the minister there? That's not your mandate. And you explained, right? The minister can delegate. Can you all talk over the offline? I think we'd just like it to be the deputy minister. Or, if unavailable, the minister, or something like that. But it should really be the DM. So unless there's a huge legal problem, Frank, then you concede on that, right? Because that's the policy thing. Then on Daniel, can you reply, or Dion?
I will try. My mic is for some reason. Chair, let me just talk about the regulatory and legal environment of the PIC. I think it will give you a much better understanding of this issue around disclosure. PIC is an asset manager. Our activities are no different from that of Old Mutual Asset Management, Alan Gray, Coronation, and so on and so forth. We are also regulated by the Financial Services Board to protect the depositors in the same way as the FSB has oversight on Alan Gray, Old Mutual, all the private asset management, private sector asset management. The difference between us and the private sector asset management is that they are owned privately. In fact, PIC owns some of them by virtue of being an investor on the JSE, like Coronation and Old Mutual and so on. They are owned by private investors. The PIC is owned by government. But in terms of what it does, it's not different from an Old Mutual asset management or private sector asset management. The FIRES Act is designed to protect the interests of the clients, the depositors in this instance. So at the moment, it appears as if the FSB hasn't got oversight on the PIC. The PIC is not doing things the way they please. That is not the case. We are regulated by the FIRES Act. And the reason that we kept saying, we cannot just disclose the client portfolios, is because we are regulated by the FIRES Act. It says that you can't do that. In the unlisted investment, we had to write piles and piles of letters to investee companies and those that are affected by the FIRES Act to give us permission to disclose their portfolios. And indeed, we did so. It was a laborious process, but we did so. Yes, yes. And we said, we are not reneging on that. We have to run that process. The client has to tell us that they are happy with valuations, prepare their financial reports. Once they say it's okay for you to publish, then we'll be able to publish. We cannot just publish at random. We have to get them to approve their valuations, publish their financial statements, and give us a go-ahead to publish the portfolio, which we have done in the past. Insofar as the listed investment is concerned, it cannot be that because the clients of the PIC are GPF, UIF, official sector funds, that we must now publish the listed portfolio when Alan Gray, Old Mutual, are also managing part of the money, but they are not allowed to do so. They are exempt from doing so. And they are our competition, by the way. We are prepared to publish, but the nature of the information will have to be managed in such a way that we don't create anxiety in the market. We will publish and we will do it annually. And by the way, some of the information we can get, because from time to time
you know, the public, the JSC does have a register of the shareholding of, you know, different entities in the stocks that are listed on the JSC. But we have to be careful because we are acting in a market economy, a competitive market. We have to compete against the private sector. And by the way, we are doing well insofar as, you know, delivering on the mandate and exceeding client expectations. And we can only do that if we contain information, and the rules of the game are similar to those of our competition.
Dr. Zen, I want to know, you see, when people start to have an interest in the listed investment portfolios, one asks one question. What is the interest to know a portfolio of an investor unless if somebody represents a rival? And to which extent are we sure that that listed portfolio will not be exposed to competitors? And I'm asking this question because more often than not, information gets leaked that are sensitive to private portfolios that belongs to investors. It has happened before. And what guarantee do we have that actually it's not the rivals who want that information but want it to certain sectors for them to understand the strategies of those who are their competitors? Because once and how does it relate to us as legislators? Why are we interested in the listed portfolios? It's got nothing to do with the work that we do. Not at all. It's got nothing to do with legislation. Once we become interested parties, there's an investment interest in it. And this is a matter that we must debate in full to understand why is that a need to do that. We said if there's been underscoring of shares or understatement or overstatements, that's got an impact. Because in this context, the PIC handle investment on behalf of pension funds. And if we believe that the share is going to drop because there's bad investment decision that has been taken, that can be discussed in incognito, in camera, for us to understand where do you play. But we don't do, we're not analysts to start with. We don't do in investment advice in terms of which portfolios you should take and which ones you should not. It's not our purview. So it becomes very interesting once we touch to that level that it might, and that's what Freud's talking about in this context. So I do not agree to a situation where we are going to pin you down to give certain details unless if there's a specific reason, and that reason must come out clearly from the onset. And that's where the market sensitivity matter chair will be discussed and how we're going to tread carefully, because here is investors who have their own private portfolios being discussed for what good reason by legislators. Interesting, I should say.
Okay, Mr. Mania, and I would like to draw to a close. Although we've got 20 minutes more, but we have to vote on this SA resolution because Frank and I have to proceed, but Cedric Frolic is waiting for the application.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to go back to Dr. Jan Machida and say it's not clear to me from your response where exactly do you stand on the transparency provisions in these bills. Do you, for example, support National Treasury's proposal that disclosure should be done not by the PIC but by depositors, and do you accept that the effect of that would actually be to significantly limit disclosure and transparency and to frustrate accountability? We need a clear statement from the PIC. That's the first point. The second point is I would be interested in your response to the argument that although you correctly point out that the PIC is an asset manager and that in your view it should be treated in exactly the same manner as other asset managers, what would your response be to the argument that in fact although the PIC is an asset manager, it should actually be subjected to higher levels of scrutiny precisely because it invests the funds of the government employees pension fund, which, as the chairperson pointed out, is a defined benefit fund, and ultimately the risk is to the public and the taxpayers.
Chair, I think we are becoming unfair to Dr. Dan Makira now. It seems as if he's in an interview, you know. It could be Dr. Makira today, but it could be somebody else tomorrow. So if we are now directing a question to him that says, what is your view on this matter, I think we are really unfair to him.
Floyd? Chair, I think the let's move from the basis that the regulatory framework that exists for all asset managers will exist for the PIC as well. So it must not be like the regulatory framework that exists for for all asset managers is what is applicable to the PIC, like the financial advisory and intermediary act services, the FICE Act that deals with all the issues that are related in terms of the whole issues of disclosure and transparency. I think it's adequate and must not understate the fact that there are people who want to sabotage or to undermine the standing of the PIC. So that later on they will come back and say that the PIC is incompetent, it's not bringing the necessary returns, let us instruct GPF to allocate funds to other asset managers. That is the whole target, that the PIC is managing trillions of rands from government employees pension fund. And the other private role players want to have access to those resources as well. And how do you get there? Cripple the PIC. I don't think we should be party to that. We should not be party to that. If we are we're serious about transparency, if we are proposing transparency, let us go and change the act that regulates all asset managers. Must be same rules for all asset managers in terms of what should happen. If we are truly about transparency and consensus, because asset managers mentioned funds, it's money of people. We as public representatives represent all the people, not just government employees or not the union. We are a parliament of all South Africans. So if these rules that we must pass, let us apply them in terms of what should happen. Of course, there are certain things that we'll put in a way that is much more adequate to make sure that the PIC is accountable. But we must not sabotage it, we must not put it in a place that will undermine its integrity and then it's endangered. And then later on, there's a proposition that it must not be the asset manager for government employees pension fund and UIF and all these other funds that exist. So we must always be able to read the undertone of what the particularly people who represent white capital come and propose to do.
Well, we're going around in circles, but it's people's right to do that. It's 20 to 1, I suppose. But 5 to 1, we have to stop because we have to vote on. So.
Because until David made this. So
No, I was about to say. No, you're right. Yeah. So, David, you repeat what you said, and then people repeat what they said in your reply to you. So you bring this upon the committee, but it's your right. So, Daniel, you have to answer in terms of parliamentary rules. It's directed not to you personally. You're the CEO. So you're speaking on behalf of the PIC, and it's his right to ask you a question as the CEO.
I think, Chairperson,
before he responds, the committee has not requested him to make a statement. It was David's view, so we are not requesting a statement.
No, it's not a statement. You have to reply to the question, yes.
Chairperson, we agree that the Treasury is going to lead the response for the GPF and the PIC, and I think Treasury has done so.
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
I mean, I think Dr. Machin has lost an opportunity, but I accept that that's his reply. But then can we have a reply from the National Treasury? Thank you.
Please. Oh.
Because in our comment we said it should be considered whether the depositor should not be the one disclosing. We just put it before the committee. We're not saying that's what, and then we continue to say, but if it's retained only unlisted with consent and listed
with... Chair, my question was this. Does the PIC and National Treasury accept that if we were to adopt their proposal, that in fact the effect would be to limit disclosure and to frustrate and limit accountability? Does the National Treasury accept that? And if they don't, why don't they?
No, Chair, we cannot continue like this. You see, we're allowing David to...
No, this is right. I can do nothing.
No, but you see, there's a collective agreement here on how we want to proceed. We're not going to be governed by the views of an individual who wants to put the PIC and the National Treasury in a corner on an issue that we have not even finalized yet. You see, well, operating as a collective, and David must subject himself to this collective, which is this committee. And clear guidance has been given by this collective. So we're not going, because this endless right of David to act on behalf of the committee and want to put to others, we have never asked for a statement for them to consider on certain things. It's his view. And they've put a matter before us that we need to deal with, and we are going to finalize this matter. And he keeps on going on because he wants to make a statement. He can go in as well and make a statement on behalf of the DA outside.
Floyd? No, Chair. At this stage, we're at the process of writing law, and the DA has made certain proposals. National Treasury has made its own input. The unions have made their own input. We're going to later on go section by section and then agree on a formulation which will represent, of course, what we as the committee think should be the final version. So what National Treasury or individual think and everything else is of course important, but it's, I don't know why we have to be in a ping pong situation which this guy is trying to get us into now. It's not necessary. We're going to deliberate on these issues. He's going to make his own point and not try to be some prosecutor who can be asking questions in an interrogating way, but also like a with some way of saying that if you then you don't agree with me, then it means you are corrupt. That is the whole intention. I don't think we must take it in that way. Let us deliberate. Let's write laws, and then we are then be able to agree on what we want to table in the national level of adoption.
Chair, I'm simply asking National Treasury to defend its proposal. National Treasury doesn't seem to be able to do that, and neither does the PIC. If they want to defend their proposal, why not give them the opportunity? My question is, do they accept that the effect of their proposal would be to limit disclosure and to limit accountability of the PIC? And if they don't accept that, why don't they accept that?
They have already answered that, but you can answer quickly and we're drawing to a close now.
What is this question that you must ask?
Look, firstly, it's not Mr. David Mania's rights. It's every member's rights. I have no authority as the chair of this committee to undermine the rules. We have already adopted a resolution in this committee after consulting Cedric Frolic, chief with Jackson Mtembu, when it came to the use of information in respect of a previous matter. I had no choice. I have no authority to stop him. I can merely plead with him not to be repetitive. But this is Parliament. Who showed me a rule? But you know, David, with due respect, you have rights, but you shouldn't abuse them either. I think Floyd makes the main point. Can I suggest something to you? Floyd is basically saying, if I can extrapolate, this is not their bill. No bill is theirs. Once it's tabled here, it's ours. Firstly. Secondly, this bill more than ever, it's literally yours and ours, right? And they've answered the question. And remember, some of the questions that they answer are really questions that should be directed to their, in case of MP at least, their political head, the minister or the deputy minister, whatever. This is a political question. They have answered you. They've said what they've said. They've been fairly comprehensive. Now, Mr. Menia, it's reasonable for somebody to presume that because the media is here, and it's reasonable to presume you're presenting yourself as the paragon of transparency and virtue and democracy, and the ANC which brought this about is so moribund and corrupt that you, using our traditional values, and, you know, it's reasonable for a person to presume, right? And knowing your, my experience of you, my endless experience of you and the media and me, that's a reasonable thing for somebody to presume. But let not, I'm saying it's reasonable, I'm not saying it's true. Now look, to cut matters to the chase, can you once more repeat what you said, MP? And if, Daniel, you want to say something, it's fine. In 1 minute, and then I'm suggesting we draw to a close. It's a public hearing. It's a public hearing. And therefore, we take no final decisions here. It is outrageous for a committee, in my view, and we've never done this before. In a public hearing, we're still mulling over the thing. Frank and Zakila are still meant to prepare the document, deciding certain things. We are setting the tone for the further discussions. Can you quickly reply, please?
See, the only thing I want to add is that one can't say that because it will be determined on what the GPF or the UIF or the Compassion Fund Letters License says. So if Parliament decides there should be more transparency in how they invest their funds, then the laws there should be changed if it's not transparent enough. So for instance, the GPF law, which is administered by the Minister of Finance, that law can come before the committee, and that law can be changed if you think they're not transparent enough. So I can't say it's to be more limited, or they may voluntarily disclose the information. Just read the headlines tomorrow, what you will have written. That's what he's going to write.
Chair, it's reasonable to...
Chair, I just wanted to add here. We are committed to transparency. We said we will publish...
There's no need to repeat all that. Yes. Fine. Can we move on? Please answer the question. We can't get him to answer the same question in a different form. There's no different content to you now. You're basically leading him to say that their position, which is actually a position of the majority in this committee, we've covered the ground, Mr. Menia. We are saying yes to transparency, yes to the tackle against corruption, no to Sweden in the 60s in a country like ours. By the way, I forgot to tell you, Stefan, in 1996 I was in Sweden. They asked me, representing the ANC, what sort of country do you want? I said, Sweden in the 60s. You know what their reply was? These were academics and they laughed and they said, we too want Sweden in the 60s. That's in 1996, right? So, declaring.
Chairperson, I'm pleading with Honorable David. As much as we all have rights, and I'm also pleading with you that you must not allow him to abuse you and abuse the rights. Those rights, Honorable David, they go with responsibility. I think you are overstepping. This is a public hearing. Presentations have been made. We have to ask questions for clarity. We are not in a bargaining council where we have to reach a consensus and convince each other. I think clarities have been concerned, but I'm pleading, Chair. This thing is, David is just stepping on you.
You made your point. Okay, it's not nice when it's about the rules. I can do nothing. Right, having said that, now I want to say as a chair that, in fact, Mr. Menia, for now we've come to where we have. We're meeting on Tuesday. Daniel, don't disappear. I need to speak with you and Mr. Potter-Etienne for a few minutes about next week's agenda. But I have to, please, because we have to process the thing in terms of the rules, right? Thank you very much for all of you. Those of you who can stay, you can stay. It might interest you. It's about openness and transparency. I hope Amabangana would stay here because I don't want another letter, right, on misinformation. It's a lot of work, actually. I get endless. I'm seeing there's 4 letters here this morning on other issues also. So firstly, as I said, I drafted this thing after conferring with Tandi, right? On the top, I've put in what Mr. Jenkins said. These are the rules, right? Now, I want to plead, right? Let's not carry an inquiry here. The committee section met following Tandi's briefing of me. I also spoke to Mr. Menia after that about what happened on the 16th, right? Was it the 16th? And after discussion, the committee section in general has agreed that there was a mistake on their side. There was no malice intended by any staff member. We explored that. The person had acted in good faith.
And somebody else had also acted in good faith, and both of them have since in different ways apologized. And so we've urged the committee section that in future, when it comes to an application for such a sensitive issue like closing a part of a meeting, the chairperson must be involved directly. And in our case, as you know, I draft most of this thing after conferring with Sakele and Frank. And that's what it, Frank and Sakele contributed to this, right? I made most of the changes they wanted. So the first part, we're just accepting that it was a misunderstanding and a botch-up. We're not going to carry out some inquiry here. The committee section has done all of that. Then we explained what happened on the 27th of March meeting. Yes, we took a decision on the 27th to close the meeting as far as it applies to market-sensitive issues. As Tandy also said to me, you can't close the whole quarterly meeting, right? So it can only be that section unless the whole meeting is about market-sensitive issues, right? And then we explain why in paragraphs. So committee section 4 says, the committee is clear that the public has a vested interest in the performance of SAA, especially since the government bails out for SAA is ultimately funded by the taxpayer and the company is ultimately owned by the public. SAA therefore has to answer on its quarterly performance in committee meetings that are open to the public. Interesting, same issues arise here with markets. However, the committee is acutely aware of how competitive the airline industry is and believes it is not fair to expect SAA to report on market-sensitive issues in the public domain that would serve to advantage its competitors. The privately owned airlines, notice Floyd, are not, after all, required to report market-sensitive issues in the public domain, to Parliament at least. Hence, while SAA is a state-owned company and answerable to the public, it is operating in a market economy, just like any privately owned airline, and is reporting to Parliament, and its reporting to Parliament should not undermine its prospects of being better than its competitors. Six, it's also likely the committee will get more comprehensive and clearer answers to some of the more sensitive questions around SAA's performance and plans in a closed meeting where SAA representatives are not concerned about what their competitors might glean about them. This will probably assist the committee to be more effective in our oversight role. While SAA's quarterly reports to the committee will dealt with open meetings, can I stress that? Please, to the media, please, it's an open meeting, okay? Not the whole meeting will be closed. The Senate committee will seek permission in terms of the rules that neither Tandy nor I drafted and have nothing to do with Rule 184 to consider. In terms of the rules of Parliament, the SAA market sensitive issues in the closed session of the meeting. This is the hub of the whole thing, Section 8. The closure of a part of the meeting, not the meeting media, the part of a meeting would broadly be consistent with the following process. One, at least 10 working days before an SAA quarterly briefing, the minister or deputy minister or SAA chairperson or CEO may request that specific market-sensitive issues should be dealt with in a closed session, maybe say of an open meeting, of an otherwise open meeting, right? Because poor Tandy got pilloried by the press, right? It's not her fault. I was out of the country and I didn't brief her because I didn't think this would blow up. I'm never going out of the country again, Tandy, unless you go with me. Otherwise, open meeting, right? Before we get constitutional challenges from everybody. The committee will refer this to the Speaker's office. Those of you that go to court, deal with the rules and the Speaker's office. Please don't write to me. I didn't make the rules. Tandy didn't make the rules. C. If the committee is granted notice, if the committee is granted permission to discuss those issues in a closed session of a meeting, it will do so using Rule 184 to close the meeting. 4. The documents related to the closed session of a meeting will be separated from other documents dealing with issues that are addressed in the open session of a meeting, and the documents related to the closed session will only be distributed at that session and returned to the committee after the session ends. Now, Mr. Menya, you are covered here. I want to tell you, after I spoke to you, Menya was right. Mr. Menya was right. He said, actually, in his exchange with Jahana, well, let's not mention names, right, with the DMs, the point was, market-sensitive issues don't arise from questions they get beforehand alone. Sometimes you ask a question. He gave me a very good example over the phone, which I don't want to repeat here. It was easy. Right? And so on. So now, he said, you know, you ask us questions, we can't really reply without alerting people because there are negotiations underway that are sensitive. And if we say no, and yet you find out there are negotiations taking place which are closed, you will say you lied to Parliament, right? So sometimes can we say, We'll answer that question. Can we do it in a closed session? So this is Mr. Mania's intervention, right? This is how we covered you. Where questions relating to market-sensitive issues are raised unexpectedly in a fully open meeting, these will, through preferably consensus or with a decision of the majority, be deferred to the end of a meeting to be dealt with in a closed session. Now, this is the rub. Okay, as the media listening carefully, right? Especially Ahmad Bungana, because they'll get heated up. However, very carefully, and I am now reading it slowly. If, even though I read it slowly, you will see some journalists will write that we're closing meetings. If, after consideration of the market-sensitive issues in a closed session, the committee decides that the issues are not market-sensitive, it will decide to release the documents or information in some other way and report on the content of the closed session in an open session. The deferred, well, that's a practical thing, they come in on the 7th of June. I spoke to Mr. Jakhana. Unless I've misunderstood him, what he said was, given that all the documents are now in the public domain, for the 7th of June, they do not want to, I'll check with them this evening, once this thing is adopted, I'll send it to them, they do not want to apply. So the 10 days rule must be waived for today because we're only adopting it now, right? Secondly, his only concern is the point Mr. Mania raised, and that we can deal with. And Mr. Frolic is waiting for us. And finally, you know, as politicians, we've done our bit now. It's between Frank and the Speaker's office and the Rules Committee. My job now is to sign something I read beforehand. So I think we should attach this resolution once it's finally adopted to it, and we move forward. Actually, I was a bit surprised, Tandy, I want to tell you, I didn't know all these things. After consulting with Frank and looking at other things and speaking to Cedric Frolic and others, actually, we do have a lot of power as chairs to close a meeting. I didn't know that, actually. Yeah. So, colleagues from Mbabungana, don't write to me, please. Write to the Speaker and the Chair of the House. I don't do the rules, right? You send me endless mails, all of you. There's nothing to do with our committee. I'm very busy. Write to the Speaker. Go to the Constitutional Court. Nobody's challenged Rule 184. We will apply Rule 184. And to be fair to Tandi, I want to rescue Tandi, my sister there. Tandi acted in good faith. And I was in China where Gmail doesn't function. I've forgotten, okay? And so it was very difficult to WhatsApp and Gmail. And I got all this thing later. And remember, we're 6 hours ahead and so on. We're sleeping while Tandi's getting heated up with me. Yeah, she called the whole night. Obviously, I was sleeping. Why must I be awake? Who thought something like this would blow up? You know, normally when Tandi is here and I'm gone, it works out wonderfully better. Meetings are shorter, there's less blabbering, and things get done. So Tandi is totally innocent here, but the staff also, to be fair. No one's accusing them. There's no malice. They all meant well. So, I want to suggest that, look, there's nothing controversial. Frank, you approved of this, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, Mr. Mania and Floyd.
Chair, I think we should tread carefully here because the effect of this resolution and implementing it may be to close certain meetings on its own.
As session of a meeting.
The effect may be to close part of meetings on SAA. Now, I've had a look at the resolution and I've got the following comment. The first is, I mean, you've made reference to Rule 184, which we must obviously comply with. But the rule only sets three conditions in which a meeting could be closed. And those conditions are when we are dealing with a matter of a private nature that is prejudicial to a particular person, that is a matter protected under privilege, or for any other reason privileged in terms of the law, or is confidential in terms of information. It's a closed list. There's no provision in that list to close a meeting or part of a meeting because of market-sensitive information. So that's the first point. The second point is that, to the best of my knowledge, and I'd really be wrong, and I'm sure that Advocate Jenkins would correct me, is that there's no definition in law of what market-sensitive issues. It's not defined in law. So that's a second point. It is a vague term. There is a term, commercially confidential information, which is not the same as market sensitive, and it only applies to third parties, not to the entity itself. So there are three categories of problems. The term that we use here, market sensitive issue, is not defined in law and is vague. The second is to suggest that meetings could be closed, or parts of meetings could be closed to deal with market sensitive issues outside the rules of Parliament is a closed list. The third is that I'm not sure that we would have, in any event, authority in law to agree to that. That's the substantive issue. There are two other minor issues, and that is, I think it's factually incorrect to say that on the 27th of March the committee agreed. I think that's factually incorrect. The only record that we have is the PMG minutes, and I accept that that might be in dispute, but the PMG minute reads that the committee would explore the possibility of having a closed meeting to engage on market-sensitive information. That is not the same as to say that the committee agreed. In fact, I think the committee didn't agree, and I think that that provision should be changed. Even if you disagree with me on all those points, Chair, I would still suggest that 8A be strengthened, because I agree with you that a request would have to be made, but then I think that the minister must specify in what these market-sensitive issues are. So his request must be specified. He must provide reasons in terms of the rules of Parliament why he's requesting the meeting to be closed, and most importantly, he must provide the authority in law. My strong recommendation, Chair, is that you should pause and possibly reconsider. I think that this proposal is the definition is vague, which could lead to disputes. I think if the proposal is outside the rules of Parliament, and I think that we should strongly reconsider this resolution.
Let me just help with one practical thing to save time. No, to save time. It's a bit sensitive, but I will protect the staff member. Yeah, you can make a...
Chair, also I think the two first, the first and second paragraph which deal with the history of this matter, I would suggest we just delete that. We accept that whoever was responsible, that it would be dealt with. But ultimately, I mean, the chairperson is responsible and should take responsibility and not just simply blame staff.
I told you over the phone what happened. I think it is wrong. It is immoral of you to raise it. I told you what happened over the phone. You want me to say that here?
I'm speaking to these two paragraphs which...
No. You have to have those two paragraphs. It's wrong. What was done... was done without the knowledge of the chair and the acting chair.
I accept that.
Yeah, and I said I'm not going to crucify a member of the staff here. No. That's not negotiable. No, we cannot.
No, politician.
No. That's
take responsibility.
Cheap. I shared this information. You know the sense. Yeah. It's honest. No. Look. Firstly, let's start with the information. The information is the following. I drafted this to say that the meeting decided to close because that is what is reflected in the minutes that we have to adopt next week, given to me by the staff member concerned. That's what it says. Exploring the possibilities of exactly my words. That's the way I speak, right? As a journalist once said to me, we know exactly who speaks. And somebody asked me whether I leaked something one day. And then somebody else in the end said, Eunice, he speaks exactly, he talks to the media exactly the way he speaks. You can tell his style. He wouldn't have done it. It's true, I hadn't done it, right? But somebody who speaks very similarly to me had done it. I can tell you outside. So let me be clear. I think Mr. Mania is right. And in fact, one of the staff members also said the same thing. But the minute taker put it down as a closed meeting, you can't say that. I would never have agreed to that. Not that I know much. I said explore the possibilities of. So I think we can tweak that. That's a fact. Having said the fact, and I'm correcting it up because that's what I think happened, the minute taker will have to change the minutes before we adopt it next week, whoever the minute taker is. But the person, you mustn't crucify the person. And it's, there's some things really. You know, David, you need to search your conscience about really. I shared with you over the phone. I said, do you want to crucify that person? What that person did was wrong. And you knew and you were very understanding over the phone. Why are you now saying we're blaming that person? Actually, that person should be, frankly, sanctioned by Parliament. And I decided in a humane way that it shouldn't be done. Okay? Two people, actually, not just one, should be sanctioned. Just withdraw that. That has to stay there. That's the deal we struck with them. That the persons concerned will not be sanctioned. They are not sophisticated enough. They haven't been trained enough. Can you imagine somebody in the committee section drafting something like this, David, with the distant part? Because I speak English and because I got a master's in sociology, I'm able to do this. Is it fair to ask younger people to do it?
Can't you be culturally sensitive or racially sensitive?
I'm actually the person who's acting for them. I'm saying you and the acting chairperson should take your responsibility and not blame them. And
no, but we're not there. It was done without our knowledge.
So delete one and
no, no, no. It was not. It was done
consistent.
No,
with
no, no. It's not consistent. You are being. No, I'm not allowing this.
It is.
I want to make something utterly clear. Mr. Mania is fully informed about the staff member concerned, the first one and the second one. Their names were given to him. I had the choice as a chair to call for their discipline. One of them could have been expelled from this committee. But you have to be humane. It's again an insensitivity to historical disadvantage. I am never going to be party to this. Right? So,
that is what I agreed to.
Do you want me to really say what happened here?
You're arguing with a straw man.
No.
I'm saying
I could have said, I put it gently by saying, no, right, fine, look here. Floyd, I hear you, but I'm not allowing it. Right. Now, here it is. No. I simply said, without the active involvement, actually, the non-involvement, I was never involved in it. I didn't even know about it, that application. And you know that. So don't talk nonsense here. It's utter lie.
Chairperson, I think there's a substantial issue that we have to deal with. Outside of...
Yeah, let's deal with the substantial issue, Floyd.
Just quickly, that... When SAA was shifted from Department of Public Enterprises to National Treasury, was to say that the Minister of Finance must be the executive authority over it. And that was on the premise that National Treasury will better oversee SAA. I think there was even suggestions then that certain people must consistently meet with the board and management of SAA. When Kutumiene was still there, right? Now, it's objectively clear that National Treasury has not been able to impactfully oversee SAA to proper recovery. That is one. But two, Cabinet took a decision last week that it's going to combine the assets of SAA Express and South African Airways. Wouldn't it be wise from a practicality point of view that SAA is shifted back to public enterprises that in terms of the executive authority now, so that the merger process are not frustrated? I think that is the message that we should communicate to National Treasury when they come on the 7th, because I think that National Treasury should come to give a report outside of the board and management of SAA. National Treasury must come and say that ever since SAA was shifted to your oversight, what practically have you done and why haven't all your interventions succeeded? Isn't it then wise to then take SAA back to public enterprises and then the public enterprises oversees it and also facilitates the process of the merger of SAA Express and SAA into an entity? It would be better if this one executive authority, because if you've got two executive authorities over SAA Express and SAA, it might delay or even frustrate the process of the merger, which is long overdue, and we should shop. I think that as a committee we must take that posture so that we then focus ourselves on other issues. We've got legislation to pass before the end of the 5th Democratic Parliament.
Right, we've already taken that decision. We have recommended to the executive, I think in two reports, Alan, that it should be moved. I spoke to Minister Nene 3 weeks ago. I spoke to Minister Godan last week. So we've taken that decision. We don't want SAA here. Moreover, let me tell you what my argument with Nene was, with Praveen Nene was. That the issues about SAA are primarily about strategy. They're about restructuring. They're about entering into some relationship with the unions on managing some of it. They're about strategy, they're about program, they're about dealing with the airline industry and its competitive nature. It's not financial. The financial issues follow from that. It is not something that's hidden. Even the peasants in Mongolia know this. The reason SAA was moved here had nothing to do with the structural challenges SAA was having. It's to do with particular dynamics of personalities and a particular president. It was moved here. There's no rational explanation for why it was moved here. Because all state-owned entities were challenged. Why weren't they all moved? You see, if we managed SAA more effectively and efficiently, if we had a clearer strategy, then the finances will fall into place. So we can pass another resolution, Floyd, next week, Tuesday, and send it to the minister. I've done it. I do a lot of work outside the meeting instead of writing that. So I spoke to Praveen last week. After he, in fact, gave a statement, I told him, listen, when are you taking SAA away? That's a standing resolution, I think, in two, maybe three reports. We wanted to go. When Malusi was here, I spoke to him about it. When Nene was here, he was shrugging his shoulders, he has to take over. And then we had Praveen for a while. So you're right. There's no rationale or justification for keeping SAA here after the Prime Minister said he's going to rationalize the three. So I'll write another letter and just refer them to previous decisions, Floyd. Now, on this issue, can I suggest we have a long discussion? Frank, is there anything that's irregular here? Yeah. It's a rules matter. Yeah.
Yes, I'm dealing with the rules, Chair. I want him to consider when he responds. Because, you see, Advocate Jenkins, the GA only focuses on Rule 184A and doesn't interpret Rule 184B, which gives effect to... You want me to read it? It says... close the meeting for a decision by the committee or subcommittee whether the matter should be considered in closed session. So they don't interpret this part of the rule. The same rule, but they only quote A and then don't quote B. So because you're the only legal advisor who can interpret the rule, can you please help in interpreting B so that members are clear as the powers that the committee has?
Can you also remind us how the state-owned, what Public Enterprises Committee, Tandi, they closed a session of a meeting recently to discuss what they should do about these Guptas. Can't the NPA get its act right now? These Guptas and that, what's that, Dudu, right? They didn't appear before them. Didn't they have a closed meeting, I read in the media, just to deal with that issue? The DA, your Natasha Mazzoni, probably participated. Where does it say they... where does it say in the rules that if people are given what you call subpoenas and they disappear and they don't take the subpoenas, then you can close the meeting? How do they close the meeting in terms of the same rule, presumably? Explain how they did it. And we'll use whatever rule. I don't want an endless discussion here. You have a chief whip, right? You can go to the speaker's office. You know what? Let's note some of these things. So, and then the last one, let's change it to consistent, we can drop all of this, say consistent with Rule 184, the committee will in fact close sections of the meeting, right? If that's a problem. So what I suggest is we take a decision here that we're doing this exactly, we ask you to reword it, send it to, and discuss it. But one thing we are clear about, we are going to close the meeting where we feel it falls within Rule 184. Help us with that.
Chair, thank you very much. I think I'll try and keep it brief because we're in the lunch hours and I mean everybody's hungry. But the starting point is Section 59 of the Constitution, which says that the National Assembly may not exclude the public, include the media, from a sitting of a committee unless it's reasonable and justifiable to do so in an open and democratic society. So that's the test. That's the critical test. Is it reasonable and justifiable to do so in an open and democratic society? What Rule 184 attempts to do is to concretize that. So it gives certain examples, but it cannot take away the power that's given to committees and the National Assembly in terms of the Constitution. And it is reflected in Rule 184. Honorable Mania read subsection B, 1, 2, and 3 as a closed list. That's how I understood what he read. And that deals with a matter which is of a private nature and is prejudicial to a particular person who is protected under parliamentary privilege or is confidential in terms of legislation. But there's a subparagraph below that which refers to the constitutional issue, which then speaks the nature of which is such that it is confidential, that its confidential treatment is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society. So the example, excuse me, that you've mentioned, Honourable Chair, of the Public Enterprises Committee certainly fits into that area. In that area where the Constitution says, apply your mind, is this reasonable and justifiable in an open democratic society? Can you, should you be challenged, be able to bring it up? And I think SAA falls within it. And a similar thing happened in a joint meeting with the Standing Committee on Public Accounts and Water and Sanitation, which I was part of, where we listened to what the SIU wanted to say about reports that has not been made public and has been sent to the President. And we've closed that last part of the meeting for various reasons. And part of that discussion we had could be fit under it's a private nature that might be prejudicial to a person, and parts will be more general, which we say, look, this is not reasonable and justifiable in an open democratic society to talk about a report that is still before the President for his consideration. Let me leave it there. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I would like to suggest we draw to a close. It's not for us to debate it. It's a rule, and if you have problems with the rule, then, you know, well, your chief whip must go and speak to the speaker's office and so on and change the rules in the rules committee. We will do it in the rules, yeah, very quickly. We're not going to have an instant.
Chair, I don't have any problem with the rules. In fact, what I've advocated is an argument for applying the rules, and I think this resolution is inconsistent with the rules, and therefore I'd like my objection to the resolution noted.
Can I say that the following changes, the first two are non-negotiable, and please don't release in the media the people concerned. It'll be shocking, but you're quite capable of that, the staff concerned. I think we should explore the possibilities of what I tried to do.
Can we just clarify this? Yeah. We ad idem on this. The point that I was making was
two paragraphs
are superfluous.
I think it's immoral what you're doing here. Knowing full well, I briefed you, I gave you names.
But why is it immoral for me to suggest that you should take responsibility?
I can't, because you know what happened. I don't know that the application was made. How can I take responsibility for an application I don't know was made? I didn't make the application. I had nothing to do with it. So how can I take responsibility for something I had nothing to do? It wasn't that I was out of the country. I didn't know the application had been made. The first time I discovered it was when the media contacted me to say, why are you closing the meeting? I didn't know about it. Look, I'm not having this. Can we just move on? We can't vote on this resolution, right? What we're agreeing on in principle is that I will change the wording because qualification, they later said, it never meant. So explore the possibilities of, right? And then what we could do, between you and me, discuss it. We will vote on it on Tuesday morning. And we will note the DA's objections no matter what we do. I hope the media is impressed about this valiant, heroic freedom fighter for liberty and equality, and he's being oppressed and suppressed and repressed by this committee in an open meeting. And I hope you're giving some award, global award, for how he's fought the oppression of ANC-led chairperson of this committee, right? That's what's going to emerge in the media. Your statement might all... By the way, he issues statements before he even says it. Yes, it's probably in the media already, right, that he fought this resolution. And you must be more investigative. Engage with people. Ask them, you know, questions rather than lump just to say. Now, on that matter, can I raise something else now on SAA? As I understand it, SAA has got no issues for this coming meeting anyway, okay? But we should apply for a generic resolution that allows us to do this. Why is it? Oh, no, there's no resolution at the moment. Yeah. Yes, but we haven't adopted the resolution. You can send the draft resolution. He can send it to you. But I need it for my notes. Oh, right now, sure. Yeah, you're disruptive as usual, Linda. As much as we love you, very disruptive. I'm a Bungana. Where in the world will you have this media people interrupting like that? Right? So we're not as authoritarian as you think we are. And go and do some Googling. No way in the world has ever got a parliamentary committee I know of that allows people to make submissions, including yourself, on the day we vote on the poll. Go and Google that. Right. No. The meeting's over. You can stay. No. Not on this issue, because the rules apply to you as much as to us. On a different issue. Okay. What is the issue? First, tell me what the issue is, because the members have to agree. It's not on the agenda. What issue?
Did I understand you correctly to say that you're going to put an application for a closed meeting for the next session with SAA?
No. I said we will have to adopt a resolution on Tuesday. And I will alert Mr. Frolic that he'll be getting one on Tuesday afternoon. Right? But it is if it's necessary. We'll give him the resolution, but then if it's necessary on Wednesday, when Thursday when they come, a market-sensitive issue is raised. We're not applying for an a priori one. Then we will close it in terms of the resolution. Thank you. And then, yeah, there's no indication for now. But if you ask him questions like, how are you competing against, what's this, your favorite people, British Airways and Kulula.com, right? The people you would probably identify with. Then we'll say, no, that's market sensitive. Okay. No, not funny. Actually, you're bordering on immoral, actually. I think you're immoral. I actually think you have no conscience, really. You can quote me on that. I think David Mayne has got no conscience. Thank you.
I have no idea.